We've met in closed session and discussed our labor negotiations, and we are now in open session. Is there a consensus on the order of business? One?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. The minutes from December 9th, 2014. Everyone had any changes, corrections, additions, otherwise?
I'll move approval of the minutes of December 9th, 2014.
And I'll second that.
Okay. Any further discussion? All approved? All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, thank you. This is our one of the best times of the evening. Our student representatives to the board, John O. Roberts, is here from San Luis Obispo High School, and I understand you brought a guest, Lauren McGregor, with you tonight. So report away.
Hi, everybody. I'm going to keep it short and sweet, much like myself. I've got two things I want to talk to you about. Before we ended for the holidays, I had talked about how we were putting on a week of giving and receiving, and that went very well. We had a coat drive. We brought roughly 700 coats in. We brought them in. The lady started crying, said how much they needed them, and it was really awesome that we were able to do that. We also had our Life Water Well that passed with flying colors. We got all this water to donate to children who need clean water in more deprived countries where they don't have it. And we were also able to put together a good experience for all of our students to tell them explain to them the benefits of when you give and the heartwarming feeling you can receive during the holidays that not everybody gets to experience. And the second thing is we have the color run coming up on the 24th. ASB is promoting it. We're not putting it on, but we're promoting it. And it's the second time they've done it, and all of the proceeds, I believe, go to the Alex Mayer Memorial Scholarship Fund. So that'll be on the 24th, and if you want to do that, you can walk it too. I might do that. It's a blast and a half, literally, color blast. And you should go onto their website, which is escaping me at the moment, but that's where you would sign up if you wanted to. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
I was just saying that Catherine was a work of art when she participated in that last year. I saw a picture of her.
I got pinked.
Okay, thank you. Lauren, anything to report? Okay.
Learning the ropes.
Yeah. All right, in action. As usual, we welcome your continued presence at the meeting, but we are also aware that you have other business to tend to, so it is up to you.
As much as I would like to stay, and as much as I would like to get me out of whatever tests I have, I'll have to walk away.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Jono and Lauren.
You guys have a good day.
Thank you. Next on the agenda is correspondence. We received an email from on January 7th, 2015. I believe all board members received it from Ms. Kelsey Baker regarding the Phillips 66 proposed oil rail transport project. And that is, I think that's all. Now is the time for public comment for items not on the agenda, or if it is on the agenda and you wish to speak now, you're welcome to do so. We urge you to fill out a card if possible. Is there anyone wishing to address the board under public comment at this time? Okay, seeing none, we will move on to our superintendent's updates. First is the business and budget update. Mr. Pinkerton.
Yes, so I wanted to start tonight by just letting the board know a little bit about the governor's budget proposals from last Friday. He released those proposals. And so, again, these are proposals that the governor puts out in terms of possibilities for the budget passage. There's a lot that's going to happen between now and probably May with a May revise where they kind of relook at things. And then, of course, he has to work with the legislature in determining what the true budget's going to be. But the initial budget proposal, I just want to kind of go through a few things and talk about them. So the state of California is definitely in a positive place in terms of the economy. And so due to that positive economy and the revenues that the state of California is taking in, it's basically really helpful in terms of education. And so, again, and I've talked about this a lot when we talk about us as a community-funded basic aid school district versus a state-funded school district. So they have the new funding formula, the LCFF, the local control funding formula, that most districts, that's how they receive their funds. That's the amount of money that they receive. We, as a community-funded district, our property taxes are higher than that state amount. So due to that, we don't receive any of the state funds that come in, or so as the governor is working on putting more towards the local control funding formula for schools as a basic aid, you know, district community funded, because we're already above that amount, we're not receiving any of the new monies that I'm going to talk about here in a minute. So that said, K-14 education is going to receive about $7.8 billion in increased funds based on, go ahead, Mr. Millar, did you? Just clarification, go ahead.
Yeah, you said that since we're already higher than the state amount, are you talking about the our revenue limit amount, or?
Well, it's no longer, so that would be our LCFF amount.
Okay.
So there's no longer, revenue limit's no longer really a term that we use.
Okay.
So what's happened is the state of California has set a target amount for school districts. So per student, kindergarten through three, there's an amount. Fourth through eighth grade, there's an amount. And then ninth through 12th grade, there's an amount per student. Then they have supplemental funds that's added on to that base, that target amount or base amount for students that are economically disadvantaged, for students that are ELs, and for students that are foster homeless youth. So there's an amount now in the state of California per child. The districts are supposed to be, that's the target amount that everyone gets the same amount. And the districts who have students with those in those three categories receive supplemental amount. Districts that have over 55% of those students receive another concentration amount on top of that. So if you have, you know, students in those three groups, those needier districts would definitely receive more money than the districts who don't have those students. But that said, that target amount now is the same for every district. Now,
to be what was referred to as a low wealth district because we had a super low revenue limit.
Yes.
Now. But so that's all.
That's gone.
Forget all that stuff.
That's gone. Now, the revenue limit is still a factor in that. What they've done is they've taken your revenue limit, and then you have your true target amount. And that now is what's called the gap. So all districts are not receiving their targeted funds at this point. They're receiving their revenue gap plus 2 years ago they gave a percentage towards that gap funding, and then they start a new level, and then there was a little bit more last year in terms of percent. So this next year, predicted with the governor's budget, it's going to be about 30 for those districts that are LCFF, they'll receive about 33% more towards that gap funding. So it doesn't mean 33, 20, 30, so now they've paid 70% of that gap. Each year it resets. So it's 30% of the new gap that they have each year. So, but it's still a substantial amount for those districts around us. It's great, good for them, more money towards education. But because we're already higher than that LCFF amount because of our property tax base, all that does really is provide us, you know, for us, really, it's just a cushion should we lose basic aid funding. So that, you know, that is something to look at. So last year, I believe it was about $15 million, the difference between what we received as a community-funded district versus what we would have received in LCFF. So that amount will be lower next year based on this new funding, gap funding amount. So we'll recalculate that. We'll relook at that, what that's at. So it's not a necessarily a negative thing for us, but it doesn't really mean any new dollars.
And I appreciate taking the time because I did not understand that piece.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So again, it's $7.8 billion towards education because of the increase in funds. you know, $4 billion of that is going towards the LCFF. So, and that's 32% gap funding change for those districts that are part of LCFF, as I talked about. Funds that we may receive as a community-funded district, as a basic aid school district, we will, you know, he's put money towards mandated costs again. So one of the governor's goals is really to pay down state costs or state debt that they've accumulated over the years. That's his focus. So paying off mandates, so like they did this year, the certain amount per student that they allocated. So I think they'll do something like that again for next year. So that is a positive for us. County offices of education are going to receive a COLA. County offices of education are fully funded at this time. So they're funded at their target level, unlike school districts that are still working on that gap. Okay? So they're supposed to receive a COLA from the budget. The governor last year did not pay off all deferrals for school districts. So what they did in the past to save money for the state was they would hold back on a month's worth of money that they were going to give to school districts. So it helped them in terms of budgeting and cost analysis, so kind of saving the funds versus handing them out. So as part of his budget, he's paying off all deferrals. So that's another $900 million going out to those school districts that receive deferral payments. So, again, that's really all those districts that are LCFF, not us. But for those districts that, you know, they're going to get paid back their deferral payments, which is great. It's pulling the state out of debt. He has put forward $71 million towards a COLA, 1.58% for the categorical programs that we currently have. So for us, that could – so special education, transportation, some of those. Not a lot of money, but, you know, any new money is good. He has put forward 4,000 new full-day preschool slots. So that's something I know we've talked with Dr. Prater about, really beginning to have some more conversations with the county in terms of preschool and how we can maybe work together on that component. And because as we're going to hear tonight, we have a fantastic preschool program, and it would be great for us to try to see if we can get any of those dollars for our district. So those are kind of the key revenue enhancements. Again, just a few of them apply to us as a basic aid school district. He did say in his budget proposal that he is willing to relook at the whole reserve question, because as part of Prop 2, it was going to limit the amount that school districts could have in their reserves. And so definitely something that he's put out there that he's willing to relook at that. It's kind of an interesting dynamic in that when I was listening to some people in my FICMAT class this weekend, that's good and bad, because we either want that all that reserve language to go away completely, or we really want to just leave it the way it is. Because the way it's written right now, it's very difficult to reach. So having them rewrite it and relook at it isn't necessarily a good thing. So it's either really just get rid of it completely, which is the hope, I think, in all the groups, school services, CSBA, CAS, everybody's pushing for AXA, or, you know, just leave it as it is and kind of move forward. So we'll see how that goes. Facilities was a big key. Again, governor's push for everything to be at the local level. So he definitely is really not a proponent of a state facilities bond. He really wants to get rid of state debt. It's clear. Everything that he's pushing forward is everything back to the local level. So talked about three things. Talked about developer fees and maybe taking away the growth restriction for using the use of developer fees, and also possibly looking at allowing districts to charge up to the level 2 fee. So we'll see how that goes. Again, taking away the need for state funds. Talked a little bit about raising the cap for school districts in terms of what they can borrow per $100,000 of assessed value if they go out for a bond. Currently, it's $60 per $100,000 for a unified 34 a K, you know, elementary or high school district. So you know, while that's nice to raise that amount, you still have to sell that to the public in terms of being able to charge more than the 60 or the 30. So that'll be an interesting dynamic. School districts that have a really low assessed valuation for their district still doesn't necessarily help them. And then lastly, he talked a little bit about districts being able to use routine repair maintenance funds, the 3% that we have to set aside, that districts could pull those funds and use them towards projects. it's really not enough money even now to keep up with the repair and maintenance we have. So pooling those funds is, it's really not a lot type of thing. So the developer fees part is kind of a plus, I would say, for us. The other two, we'll see, but definitely, again, push towards facility funds. We did find out from CASH, the Coalition for Adequate School Housing Group, that they are actually putting forward an initiative to put a state facilities bond on the ballot. So we'll see. We'll see what happens with that. But right now, it definitely looks like the governor, anyways, is not focused on having any type of facility bond on the ballot. Adult education. There is some money towards adult education. He's put $500 million towards that. It looks like they may fund us at our maintenance of effort for last year for adult ed. And so the tie-in, moving towards more of a consortium-based type of model within the district, but for next year to kind of get us through, because we had to have maintenance of effort the last 2 years, they are looking at funding that. So we'll see where that falls, if it really happens, comes to fruition or not. And then there's some CTE funds that he put aside, $250 million over the next 3 years, $250 each year, basically, for us to try to receive CTE grants. And I know that Kim McGrath has been working on that, you know, in particular with Cuesta College and Lucia Marr, and we've been moving in that direction already. And then what I would say is what the governor has done with facilities, with like technology, Wi-Fi, and things, is he's definitely, though pushing everything local, he is kind of, and it comes out through his budget, he is trying to put in some language that helps needier districts. So districts who don't have a lot of funds to help them with their Wi-Fi, districts that maybe don't have that assessed valuation for bonds or things like that, having programs specifically for them. But it doesn't. While that doesn't help us, it is, you know, it is something that we see coming forward, I would say. And then the last two things, basically, that came out of the proposition that I would say, and sorry I'm being so lengthy, but Prop 30, which is the state taxes that end. So the first sales tax, I believe, ends next year, and then the Prop 30 funds end 2 years from now, as we've looked at with our 7-year budget analysis, and you can see that big drop in, you know, $1 million to the district. The governor has no indication of asking the voters to keep that going and extending that. So, again, it's another debt situation that he doesn't want to keep going. This is his last, you know, he basically, this is his last 4 years. So he really has nobody that he has to worry about from a political standpoint now. And so he's, you know, he's getting a lot done and working forward. And then really I think for me, the missing component out of the governor's proposal was there was absolutely nothing that addressed the STRS-PERS liability that we're going to face over the next 6 years that we've talked about. So there's been talks about, you know, how the governor should take some of these funds and put it towards that STRS debt in particular, and then give money towards LCFF and other things to help districts, because that is going to be such a big liability as it grows. But that was completely missing from his proposal. So we'll see. Again, this is the proposal. There'll be a lot of negotiations that'll happen. We'll see where it ends. And normally we're a lot more refined in terms of where we're at with negotiation with the legislature when he comes out with the May revise.
Thank you. All right, is there anyone from the public who would like to address this update? Seeing none, we'll come back to the board. Marilyn.
Thank you. Mr. Pinkerton, the mandated cost reimbursement, I thought I understood that money was coming back, but not totally freely, that it was being earmarked for Common Core implementation.
So that's been his suggestion for use of those funds, for district to use those funds in that way. It's a suggestion.
Suggestion. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
So 2 years ago, we received, or 3 years ago, we received a big pot of Common Core funds for textbooks, for PD, for instruction, you know, things to help, which has been great. And we're spending that down, and we have to spend it by the end of this year. So I think last year he got a little smart on his own behalf, the governor did, and said, hey, if I'm going to give them one-time money, I might as well get rid of my debt at the same time for the state mandate. So he applied, he gave everybody the Common Core money, but said, okay, now this also takes away your mandated cost debt. And so he's just planning on doing that again this year.
Anyone else? All right. Thank you, Mr. Sure. Pinkerton. educational services update.
Just a couple things here. First of all, I'll be giving you updates quite often from this point forward on the local control accountability plan and how we're working. As a reminder, this is an update year for our LCAP. We do not need to, nor should we really attempt to rewrite our whole plan, especially since many of the measurements are dependent on state testing that hasn't occurred yet, and we frankly are still making educated guesses about even what that will look like. But we do want to monitor and adjust our plan. So we have set out a month-by-month list of tasks, and I'll just kind of outline those a little bit. On December 16th, we met with the County Office of Education. We went over the new template and the protocols for what the state now expects the plan to look like, because remember, we were on our own last year. Now there's a state template. This month, January, is what we're calling our needs assessment month. This is pretty much an internal cabinet-level look at where we stand mid-year. Are we getting the data we expected? Are we following through with our action steps? Do we need to turn up the heat on anything or rethink what we set out to accomplish? February will be consultation month, and so Mr. Pinkerton, Kristen Newland, myself, I will be going out to all of our school sites to share details about our budget, including the governor's proposal and what implications that may have for us. Our seven-year forecast and where we are with our strategic planning, we'll be asking for reactions and advice from our constituents. One of the things we're going to add this year that we didn't do, we did a great job of outreach last year, and I think we'll do a little less of the overall outreach, but we're really going to take a look at students this year. We are planning on holding forums at all five of our secondary schools to just get some student advice and feedback on how we're doing as a district and the direction we're moving in. So we'll be setting up at each of our school sites some student forums to get some information on how our students are feeling about our schools. March and April will be plan revision months, so that's when we will be meeting with our District English Language Advisory Committee, our parent advisory groups. That's the place where the board will give us some feedback, and then we will revise our plan according to what we're hearing. May will then be adoption month. We will publish, hold public hearing, answer any public inquiries about our plan, and it's our goal this year to bring both our budget and our revised LCAP to the board in late May. And as far as this whole process is concerned, I think it's important to remember that we've really been in this LCAP business before it became the requirement by the state. For many years, we've targeted our vision toward closing the achievement gap and being responsive to all students. We have asked for input on this vision. We've aligned our resources to that vision, and then we have told the public this is who we are. And so I think we have set out a nice, simple course of action to keep doing what we've really been doing for a while and aligning it with the state requirements. So that's the LCAP stuff. One of the thing I just wanted to report on is that last Thursday and Friday, our entire administrative team and their secretaries and administrative assistants engaged in the second iteration of something called breakthrough training, breakthrough coach training. The purpose of this is really fourfold in my mind anyway. One was to learn some management skills, especially as an executive and secretary team, to better organize time and responsibilities. The second was to be really proactive in these skills so that our administrators especially have both a career and a life, and not just a career. Third, it was to have our site leaders spend 40% of their time in classrooms and on campus and not in their office or in meetings. And that means two full days a week pretty much unavailable in the office because they're out engaged in where the game is being played. And the fourth is to produce breakthroughs at the school site and at the district level, which really is defined as goals that may seem unachievable, but are set anyway and then specifically targeted. And it was a great training. It was the second time that we've been through it, but we have a lot of new administrators and a large number of new secretaries. So it's really our hope that if you as board members or I as an assistant superintendent walk onto a school campus, there is a very good chance, a 40% chance, that the principal will not be available to us because they are busy doing their most important work, which is observing the actual game being played in the classroom and on the campus and giving feedback. Urban Meyer was not in his office last night when Ohio State won the national championship. He was on the sidelines giving feedback, making adjustments, and that is how we achieve breakthroughs in our schools. And that's what I got.
Thank you. Is there anyone from the public who would like to speak to address the educational services update? Okay, anyone from the board? All right, moving right along, 7.03, Measure D update.
Yeah, so just a really quick update for the board. Measure D, we have our first study session on Friday, which we posted today, and so that's going to, John Isom will be here from Urban Futures to talk about kind of bond sales 101, how it works, the process, you know, how we receive the funds, how they're paid, you know, just kind of taking the board through the process, the benefits and negatives throughout. And then we'll also have Julie Avnet, who will be here tonight as well as on Friday, to kind of talk about the cash flow model and how you develop that and looking at construction and phasing and costs and really tying both things together, how you go out for the bonds, how that works in terms of cash flow. And so we hope to give the board a lot of pertinent information on Friday, and that'll be from at 1 o'clock. In terms of the Measure D component itself, we're finally at the stage where we're starting to jump in now. We're starting to, you know, get moving, get flowing. Tomorrow we have our first pool design meeting with both Morro Bay High School and Slo High School with the stakeholder groups and really, you know, starting to talk about the nitty-gritty of design and how that's going to work. And we've both Mr. O'Connor and Mr. Pruitt have both set up their site committees for both high schools to get those groups going and to begin the conversation. And so we'll be bringing architect contracts to you, I believe, at the next board meeting to kind of begin those processes as well, and really getting all the stakeholders involved in designs and, you know, beginning to move things in the direction that they need to move. So it's an exciting time. It really is. So we look forward to that.
Thank you. Going to the public once again about the Measure D update. Anyone from the board? All right. We are at item 8.01. This is the public hearing on the negotiations reopener proposals from California School Employees Association, chapter number 89. We are opening the public hearing. Anyone wishing to address this? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing. Anyone from the board? Okay, 8.02, we will open the public hearing with regard to negotiations, district reopener proposals for California School Employees Association, chapter number 89. Anyone from the public here to address that? We will close the public hearing. Anyone from the board? I think this was the same thing twice.
No, one's the district response.
Oh, that's right. Oh, okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, you're right. You're right, Walt. Jim. 8.03, proposed developer fee increase, opening the public hearing on this issue. Anyone from the public wishing to address this? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing, bring it back to the board. Anybody on the board? All right. Item 9, it's time for our preschool longitudinal progress report.
Thanks, Mandy.
Okay. Great. Good evening. I'm here tonight with Diane Frost to provide you the first longitudinal progress report for our Success for All preschool program, as well as enrollment and eligibility data for both our Success for All classes and PEEP and PEEP Stars program. I would like to introduce two of our Success for All preschool teachers who happen to be in the audience tonight, Rita Rodriguez from Hawthorne and Monica Garcia from Pacheco. If you'd please stand. Okay. After we review our demographic and student learning data, we would like to share some program and perception data with you tonight in a 12-minute video. So we'll begin with enrollment information for our Success for All preschool program. This should look familiar or quite similar to the data I sent you in the Friday packet. As you know, our preschools are designed to offer a high-quality program for San Luis Coastal families who would otherwise not be able to access them due to economic hardship. We also wanted to enroll students who were English learners to provide a language-rich experience that would best prepare these young learners for kindergarten. If you look at this first graph, it shows the number of students who have been served since first opening our doors in January 2012. San Luis Coastal has provided preschool classes for 312 students so far, including the class of 14-15. All students in our programs qualified based on economic eligibility criteria. Included in the 312 students are 169 English learners, over half of the total students enrolled. Pretty impressive. Our second table provides us an opportunity to begin to look at the long-term impact of our preschool program. Early literacy is one of many factors to consider when determining our success rate. This table represents the 2012-13 San Luis Coastal cohort group, who is now in first grade. We use the benchmark assessment system, our typical reading one-on-one assessment system, to determine literacy proficiency. We compared the cohort group with students from socioeconomically disadvantaged group and the English learner group to determine if Success for All preschool was making a difference. And what you can see here by the data, it indicates that 61% of the Success for All student group demonstrated reading proficiency by the end of kindergarten, compared to 57% of kindergarten students in the socioeconomically disadvantaged group. Even more promising are the results for English learners who attended our preschool classrooms. 59% of English learner students demonstrated reading proficiency as compared to only 52% of the total group of English learners. The data suggests a strong correlation between a quality preschool and the accompanying parent education component with success in literacy. The fact that we did not reach the district proficiency rate of 68% suggests that preschool alone is not enough to close the achievement gap for our low socioeconomic students and English learners. But we do know, or we believe, preschool combined with best instruction and targeted reading intervention programs are critical in kindergarten, first, and second grade to effectively narrow the gap. Special education preschool is a state and federally mandated program for 3 and 4 year old children who meet eligibility criteria. As such, in addition to our Success for All preschools, San Luis Coastal offers a menu of special education services for our students who qualify. For instance, we have a program for students who would benefit from speech and language services weekly. This is our PEEP program. This might look like 1 to 2 days per week, 60 to 90 minute sessions with small group instruction, and generally the parents are there and involved with their students. Another offer we have is an intensive program for our students with greater needs. This is our PEEP STARS program. This might look like 3 hours per day, up to 5 days per week, with multiple services provided that might include occupational therapy, speech and language pathology, a school nurse, a psychologist, to name a few. So from very light services to very heavy services for our students based on what they might need. In addition to the PEEP and PEEP STARS programs, we're proud to serve children of all abilities together in our full inclusion program that we offer at C.L. Smith Elementary School in the Success for All classroom. Looking at data, while I've had the PEEP STARS program in the district since 2008 and the PEEP program long before that, the data we've collected for you is from 2010. You can see that the data indicates that our PEEP program, and again, that's our speech and language program, has served more than 240 students, averaging roughly 58 students per year. In our PEEP STARS program, again, that's the more intensive program, we've had a steady increase from 23 students in 2010 to a high of 47 students served in 2013-14 and more than 150 students served since 2010 alone. Because children qualify for services as soon as they turn three, so not at the beginning of the academic year, but actually when they turn three, our programs are assessing and placing students throughout the year. So you'll notice that in 2014-15, this year, our numbers look relatively low compared to what you've seen in the past. That will not hold. Come June, you will see those numbers much higher than what you see right there. Next chart. Thanks. The pie chart indicates eligibility areas served this year in our PEEP STARS program, but is similar to past years. You'll see that autism and speech and language impairments are the primary disability that are widely served in our preschool programs. One final piece of data that you won't see up on the screen today. Like all programs serving students with special needs, one of our objectives is to decrease the time served in special education classes and increase the time spent in general education classes, thereby providing the least restrictive environment for the child. Over the last 3 years, we've had almost 20 PEEP STAR students move forward to general education kindergarten with support. We think that the support received and progress made in our programs is critical in the success, and I would definitely say that the partnership that we have with the Success for All Preschool helps our students as well. As Amy said, we now have a 12-minute video for you, and I think you'll get a better understanding of what happens in all of our classrooms.
The more we get together today.
San Luis Coastal's Success for All Preschool program is the result of the school board approval of the 10 initiatives for student success. Before opening our doors in January of 2012, we took a number of steps to make sure we were ready for our first group of preschool students. We began by researching what a high-quality preschool program looks like, including for English learners, with the help of Sally Ames. We studied the California State Preschool Foundations and Frameworks and visited existing model programs. From here, we hired three incredible teachers and developed our preschool curriculum. We selected materials that would best prepare our young students for the Common Core expectations and workshop model of our elementary classrooms. We focused not only on language, literacy, and mathematics, but the social-emotional development of the preschool-age child. And finally, after meeting all licensing requirements, the first three preschool classrooms opened their doors to over 60 students at Hawthorne and Pacheco Elementary Schools. The following August, we began a class at C.L. Smith that included full inclusion opportunities for students who qualified for special education.
Good job. Keep going.
1 year later, we opened a fourth preschool class at Baywood Elementary with Fiona Lloyd Moffat as the new teacher. This was great news for our youngest learners in Los Osos, as we hear from Baywood kindergarten teachers Erin Clyburn and Erin Fay.
The students who have come in from the Baywood preschool have come in as a strong part of the Baywood community and focused and responsible learners.
They've also come in with some reading, writing, and math foundational skills, which has been so important to see in kindergarten. They've also come in loving school.
Preschool is a gateway into kindergarten. The foundation of our program is a curriculum that is designed to engage students in learning experiences that fuel their fascination and build their confidence and competence.
I'm gonna let it shine, let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. I'm
Preschool lays the groundwork for future success in a child's academic career by developing and kindling a love of learning and inspiring our children's intellectual engines. Preschool will also foster the growth of confident citizens of the school and the community. I'm gonna let it shine. Our curriculum is based on the philosophy that children learn best in a safe and nurturing environment. We support and encourage children to develop at their own pace. We provide developmentally appropriate social, emotional, language and literacy, English language development, mathematics, and physical development learning. Children learn in both inside and outside environments. They build, create, share, and dream about endless possibilities. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. Language and literacy include listening and speaking, reading and writing. Preschool students experience learning through modeled writing, journal writing, read alouds, nursery rhymes, picture books, zoo phonics, sequencing pictures and stories, dramatic play, independent reading, and tracing numbers and letters. Math and science are strong components of our preschool program. Our teachers have all participated in ongoing training in math strategies to match the shifts happening in elementary classrooms. You can find children measuring, estimating, graphing, investigating, and developing a strong understanding of number sense. In science, exploration and discovery in a developmentally rich environment provides an optimal experience for our young learners. In addition, our classrooms consist of 9 areas of interest to foster self-initiated play and integrated learning. These areas or centers include dramatic play, blocks of all shapes and sizes, a variety of art areas, lots and lots of books, a writing center, math and science, a family display, and a variety of outdoor areas. We take a very broad and holistic approach to parent education. We encourage parents to become active participants in their child's education. Our children come from very diverse language and cultural backgrounds. Relationships are central to a child's success in school. It is important that parents and teachers have a strong, positive relationship in order to foster a rich learning experience for the child. In addition to back-to-school night and parent-teacher conferences, preschool teachers offer a variety of workshops on topics of interest to the preschool parents. One important workshop introduces parents to the Raising a Reader program. Parents learn about the importance of connecting with other preschool families as well as the school to develop a supportive network for raising children. Parents are provided strategies for sharing a book with a child and the importance of daily reading time at home. Each child is given a bright red bag that goes home once a week filled with new books for the family to enjoy together. Raising a Reader is one of the cornerstones of Success for All preschool program. In addition to monthly workshops, preschool families are encouraged to start the day in preschool by spending the first few minutes in the classroom reading and sharing books with their children. This transition from home to school promotes parent and child bonding, and it ensures that children are read to by a special adult every single day. The teacher uses this time to model different interactive reading strategies for parents by kneeling down next to a child and parent and asking the child what she notices in a book, predicting what might happen next, or asking about a favorite character from the story. Parents participate in this one-on-one coaching format with the teacher that increases their comfort level and expertise in sharing books with their children. Many parents are able to stay for circle time when the class will sing, dance, move, and read the morning message. This again encourages parent and child bonding, as well as helps the parent learn the songs, literacy, and math strategies being taught that week so they can follow up at home. In addition to our Success for All preschools, San Luis Coastal boasts an early intervention preschool for our students ages 3 to 5 who qualify for special education services. The spectrum of services in this PEEP and PEEP STARS program is wide, from a program for students who would benefit from speech and language services 1 to 2 times per week to an intensive special day class program for our students with greater needs. Curriculum, activities, and facilities are similar among our Success for All preschools and PEEP STARS preschools, including an emphasis on parent education. Because of the special needs of our students, and due to the expertise of our program specialist and early intervention teachers at each site, modifications in instruction and content ensure progress among our students. In our PEEP STARS classroom, students are given an opportunity to participate in activities designed to enhance self-esteem and self-help skills, as well as social, cognitive, language, and fine and gross motor skills. The inclusion of typical peers and mainstreaming opportunities in our SDC preschools offers our students model peers to provide support for language, social, and play skills. Because San Luis Coastal provides both general education and special education preschools for our communities, we are able to provide a full inclusion program at C.L. Smith Elementary School. Students who qualify for special education services may qualify to participate in the Success for All preschool program, where highly trained aides, a speech and language pathologist, and a program specialist help support the students in this general education setting. The transition from this fully included program to a general education kindergarten is almost seamless. The importance of investing in early childhood matters for our nation's economic competitiveness. This smart investment in early childhood education will help ensure that all children have an equitable start before their very first day of kindergarten. San Luis Coastal is making an investment in these children and their parents to ensure the American dream is available to all students.
And I believe this, without this program, my daughter wouldn't be as ahead in the kindergarten and first grade as she was, as she is now.
The program has been amazing for our family because we couldn't have otherwise afforded to send our children to preschool. My son, who's now in first grade, really got a head start, and he needed the socialization of the preschool, and my daughter as well. I was just thinking on the way here how much it has changed her and really helped her, because she was a very shy child who really needed the exposure to other children, other adults, this type of environment. So the preschools have been amazing for our family, and thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for the wonder in me. Thanks a lot. Thanks for the way I feel. Thanks for the animals, thanks for the land, thanks for the people everywhere. Thanks a lot. Thanks for all I've got. Thanks for all I've got.
programs like those that you saw on the screen there take a lot of people with a lot of expertise and clearly a lot of love. I wanted to acknowledge the teachers that we have in our Peep Stars and Peep Light program. Del Mar hosts one of our programs with Noah Cooper. C.L. Smith hosts one of our programs with Andy Prue. And Hawthorne Elementary hosts our third program with Olivia Richardson. And we have two very dynamic speech and language pathologists who are working in our Peep Light program, and that's Barbara Stiles-Spittler and Marlisa Borgia. All of that support for all of those programs is by Erin Brisky. She's our program specialist, and she happens to be here today. So just for your information.
In addition to the two that I introduced to you two already, we have Courtney Miller at C.L. Smith, and we have Fiona Lloyd Moffitt at Baywood. And we have the person that did teach me everything I ever needed to know about preschool, and that's Sally Ames, and she's here tonight as well. So.
Questions? Okay, I'd like to go to the public, see if anyone would like to speak. Yes, please come forward and state your name, and you'll have 3 minutes.
My name is Rita Rodriguez, and I'm the preschool teacher at Hawthorne Elementary, and I'd just really like to thank Amy Shields. She's been a great leader when we started this program, and I need to say that I've been teaching preschool for 19 years. This is my 19th year here in the San Luis Obispo and Oceano and Cambria area, and I have to say that by far this has been the ideal situation for teaching preschool. And the reason for that is that I'm actually on an elementary school campus as a part of the school district, a part of the collaboration that takes place with the kindergarten teachers, but not just the kindergarten teachers. I get to collaborate with the first grade teachers as well as the second grade teachers, all through the grades. And also, one thing that I really benefited from last year is I was trained in reading recovery. And what that has allowed me to do is to take some of those skills that I've learned in reading recovery to preschool. I'm not expecting them to read by any means, but it's given me an appreciation of what steps I need to take in order to help prepare them make that link. Oops. Thank you.
Oh, you don't have to stop.
Well,
it's complicated.
Yeah. Okay. Anyone else from the public? Okay. We'll bring it back to the board. Marilyn, Roger, you're...
Okay. Hopefully my question will be better than my ability to...
Just leave it alone.
...manipulate this timer. we've got a vertical bar graph that makes reference to students demonstrating reading proficiency by the end of kindergarten, 2014. And I just wondered, because... one of my children was nowhere near proficient at reading by the end of kindergarten. What is meant by that term? If I know there's probably a lot that goes into it, but could you give a little nutshell?
It's a specific level of reading. It's a beginning reading level that we would expect of end-of-year kindergartners. But, yes, we do expect kindergartners to be reading by the end of kindergarten, not novels, but little books with words and with sounding out skills. So that would be a level. It's actually, I believe, level D in our benchmark assessment system. And so we measure above or beyond or below that to determine if a child has reached its common core expectations for kindergarten. Sure.
Anyone else? I'd like to thank you and Ms. Pross for the wonderful work you're doing on behalf of all the families out there and the kindergarten and first grade teachers. Thank you so much. It's very important. Okay, item 9.02 is a STEAM update.
Thanks. So tonight I'm here with the secondary principals, not any adorable 3 or 4-year-olds. Sorry, but I do have 5 dynamic secondary principals. to give you an update on STEAM education. So just to remind you, so STEAM education means part of it's what you teach. So science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics. But possibly more important, it's how you go about teaching it. So the items that you find there on the right are just reminders about what it means when we're talking about STEAM. So we're talking about authentic, real projects. We're talking about cross-curricular work with content areas working together, say science and math, creating a collaborative project. We're talking about making and creating and diving down into the complexities of something and not staying at a surface memorization level. We're talking about collaborating with others and solving problems, using inquiry and really diving in deep and using technology as a tool in order to do that. So tonight we have the five secondary principals here, and we will begin with Los Osos Middle School, and Mr. Andre Yellig will catch you up on Los Osos Middle School STEAM and then hand it off to the next, and we'll ask for questions at the end.
Good evening. At Los Osos Middle School, we're very excited about our STEAM program, and I brought a few props here. Our program is really an articulated STEAM program from 6th grade through 8th grade. At the moment, our 6th grade is sort of where the students learn sort of what we would call the STEAM toolkit, where they learn to use various different tools that they can use and then apply in their general core classes during 7th and 8th grade. We have dedicated STEAM electives in 7th and 8th grade, and that's where that integration of that toolkit takes place. STEAM also, very importantly, has an A in it, and often that's forgotten, and so I included there that we have a wonderful music program, band, choir, as well as our new fledgling theater arts classroom. Our next steps at the moment in STEAM, and I'm going to show you a quick little video that'll be a thousand words to the nth degree, is to really transform our classrooms to use more technology and really bring it up to the redefinition level. Right now, a lot of our classes are sort of at the substitution augmentation level, where we're sort of using our technology in a way that could be enhanced into higher levels and further levels. So our goal moving forward is moving up to that redefinition where we can do things with technology that you wouldn't be able to do if you did not have it. We're also building our expertise with our teachers in the Google Classroom, and then also we're working on cultivating student 21st century capacities. So I'm going to show you sort of in reverse what we do, and I believe I have to stay at the microphone. That is a sandboard. Our 7th, 8th grade STEAM elective courses designed sandboards. And it started off with an engineering design process where they designed it on a computer. They looked at all the different pieces and it started off as a flat piece of wood. Then they had to figure out how to bend the sides and the tips to make it into a sandboard, attach things on the bottom to make it slide, because they had to test it out by dunes somewhere near Los Osos. Sorry, I'm new, but there's a place where they tested it out, and they had to paint it, put it all together, and I can proudly say that we don't have any injuries, so it's been working so far, knock on wood. The interesting piece about this is as the students designed, you can see that there's multiple facets that have really been brought together in here. They're using art. They're using a lot of technology in the design process. That's the most frustrating part and the most rewarding part for our students. They weren't allowed to even touch the wood or anything before they didn't design their whole concept and redesign it on the computer to sort of see what it would look like and then develop it from there and then actually get it to work and make it turn out to what they think that they're going to have it be. So I'm going to end with a quick video from our 6th grade STEAM where they really get that toolkit where they get to learn all the different aspects of how they can integrate technology, arts, and different things into the classroom. So if I know how to work this correctly, do I look back and... All right, and then perfect.
Hi. Hi, I'm Eliza.
And I'm Adam. We're here from Los Osos Middle School 6th grade Radio Production and Broadcasting Club, sharing with you information about the STEAM program.
Students at Los Osos Middle School are all involved in a program where we create projects that require the integration of science, technology, engineering, arts, and math, or STEAM.
At the beginning of the year, the 6th grade students created board games based on science and social studies programs.
We worked together to make prototypes and all helped create our final product, a really cool board game made out of wood.
In the next unit, we created an advertising campaign for our games.
We did this using 4 different types of media: TV ads, radio ads, web ads, and print ads.
With each advertising method, we learned new technology skills, including Audacity, Scratch, Microsoft Publisher, and Windows Movie Maker.
Our next STEAM unit will all be based on ancient Egypt.
We will make a website and an educational computer game.
And we will make our own Senate game out of wood in the makerspace.
But don't think that here at Los Osos Middle School, we only do things on computers.
We also have an amazing band, choir, and drama club.
We all love the STEAM program here.
It has really made learning both fun and educational.
Hey, let's not forget our cool video production and broadcasting club.
Of course not. That's the group that produces The Lion's Roar on CEO Channel 19.
It's a great show if I can't say so myself.
You can say so for me, too. Thanks for listening to us.
That's all
from The Lion's Roar.
In conclusion, I'd like to invite you next Wednesday evening in our NPR at 6 p.m. The 6th grade students will be actually playing the games that they designed, and they're inviting the public and the community to come in and see if they can market and actually create the new Monopoly or whatever it might be that they feel they've designed. Next, I'd like to invite up Dr. Kyle Pruitt from Morro Bay High School.
Mr. Illig, just a quick question. Who was it that came up with the sandboard idea?
This was in Greg Wilcox's class in the 7th, 8th grade STEAM.
I think it's terrific because it's not the first sandboard I've seen. They've been around my house. And if you, not every child has an opportunity to snow ski or water ski or even surf. But if you live in Morro Bay or Los Osos and you make a sandboard, you can have an opportunity to get to where you can use it. So I think it's a terrific thing. Please pass that on to Mr. Wilcox for me.
I'll let him know. Thank you.
Yes, I think so, too. And I want to offer make an offer to you. I will gladly take you and show you where there are sand dunes in the Los Osos area.
Thank you.
And I have to tell you that 50 years ago or more, I used to ski down some sand dunes on something a lot less... A lot less beautiful and a lot less clever than those are. So it's a great idea.
I may. Definitely proud of our students' work. I'm sure there will be a video somewhere down the road as they're testing them out as well. So. Next Wednesday, 6 o'clock, the games. Yep, that's right. Thank you.
Good evening, everybody. At Morro Bay High School, we've started a journey this year, and I'm very proud of that journey. I formed a STEAM focus team that started in September. We meet every other day for fourth period, and the goal of that team was to begin to define what a comprehensive STEAM model could look like at a high school in the state of California. And after looking through the internet, I was both disappointed not to find an answer to that, but excited because that meant we could create one and be the first in the state. So I am proud to say that a group of teachers, administrators, we've worked very hard over the past few months, and tomorrow afternoon during our staff meeting, we will be presenting approximately a 5-minute video that will describe to our staff a comprehensive STEAM program for Morro Bay High School that will impact all students and get started on that journey with our entire staff. So I'm excited that our STEAM team was put together and we were able to do that. Our STEAM model that we are putting together incorporates four key themes, and you'll probably hear that throughout the evening as we present about STEAM in our district. But the four key elements that we're working on at our site right now, each and every day, as far as a professional development opportunity, is one, the continued implementation of the Common Core, which we know with performance tasks has critical elements to it that are important for our students' learning. Project-based learning and driving questions, in other words, driving our classes through a critical or driving question, and then allowing kids to discover that through project and interaction. A lot like you saw those kids' excitement in preschools, we want to bring that excitement back to our high school classrooms as well. And we're excited that Ms. Kim McGrath is providing our secondary teachers with upcoming professional development and project-based learning. So many of our teachers will be partaking in that. 21st century skills, what we know to be important for kids these days is to be able to critically think, to work in a group, to communicate. And so we are making the overt attempt at teaching kids how to do that effectively in their lives. So for the first time, our teachers are taking on the responsibility of teaching kids how to be effective communicators, directly teaching them how to work in groups, etc. So those 21st century skills. And then lastly, we're asking our teachers to find those interdisciplinary teaching moments and connections with each other so they can tie units together at the secondary level, which can get hard at a high school, but actually is becoming more and more successful as teachers begin to talk and share ideas and share lessons and share calendars. So we're excited about the momentum we have going over the last 4 months at Morro Bay High School, and I'm really excited to roll out our plan tomorrow to our staff and keep moving forward. Thank you very much. I'd like to introduce the studious Mr. Andy Marinello to come up from Pacific Beach High School.
I don't know.
Good evening. Thanks very much for the support you have all shown Pac Beach as we grow this STEAM program here. In the upper left, you can see the Imo Denari program, which is Terry Jacobson's art class, where every year, and I can't tell you the name of it this year because I'm having a brain. No, they've Via de Colores, I think. Yeah. It is hugely attended by the kids. It is the one art class that every student seems to want to squeeze into at Pac Beach during the marking period we offer the program. Our sustainable agriculture program is still growing. No, that wasn't supposed to be there. It is growing. Slow City Farm has just hired a farm manager that is a credentialed teacher who's going to collaborate with our farm teacher, Ann Wilder. And we have real high hopes that this teacher will be an augment to our master schedule, actually, and run the class out on the farm, which will free up some more education periods for our schedule and can teach another math section, essentially. But the kids are very much enjoying it, and even though things are, growing more slowly in the winter, the students are really getting a good look at how to prepare for the next growing season. What do the plants need? What does the soil need? And then, of course, looking at the idea of, we're not growing corn in the winter, but how do we get the corn to the market that we grew over the summer? What do we need to do to store it and to ship it? Our skateboard class, I'm not going to say it's rolling along because the farm was growing. I'm just not going there. But Manny, who's here, he completed his skateboard and actually TA'd the class one marking period. He's doing a great job for us. And that's Manny in that bulking tricep down there on the lower right-hand corner. Manny's been a great help for us. And the same fellow who brought us the skateboards, we just began yesterday our first roll at the remotely controlled submersible vehicle class. I want to invite everyone because it will be worth your time. Around 10:30 each day, you can come and just have a great time. It's amazing how the kids have collaborated, the groups that they've formed up, the questions that every student is asking of the other students in their group. It's not just stop, wait, raise your hand and ask the instructor. We've gone completely to a different place, and the students are designing their own submersibles. They're all going to end up being tasked with a specific job. Yours has to go take a picture underwater and direct the other subs to get to that same spot and pick up whatever it needs. Maybe it's garbage recovery, or maybe we'll get something better at the bottom of Laguna Lake someday. The grant that we have funding this program is also going to, well, I'm hoping to get a bus ride up to the Monterey Aquarium for the kids, where the director, former director of, well, a particular oil company's offshore submersible things that didn't work so well in the Gulf a few years back, now works at the aquarium, and he will have some remote control, much larger submersibles, and the kids will be directing the vehicles in the shark tank at the Monterey Aquarium. So we're keeping our fingers crossed and looking very much forward to that. So thank you again for all your support for this. And it's 10:30 every day for the next 6 weeks. Be there. Yeah. Thanks.
I'm going to chaperone that trip because I want to drive a submersible around a shark tank. I'm John Calandro, principal of Laguna Middle School. Right one? There we go. What did I do? I moved out of it. Oh. I'm going to go through everybody's now. There we go. So right now, the STEAM program at... I keep doing that. Anyone? Anyone? Technology? There we go. Maybe I'm clicking too fast. There we go. Right now, our STEAM activities are mostly taking place in our electives. I'm just going to leave it on this. Thank you. There we go. I'll just wave when I click. There we go. Good. All right. In the seventh grade wheel right now, and our eighth grade electives, that's where we're running most of our STEAM program. The seventh grade wheel consists of four classes. Students can select from home economics, our shop class, which incorporates wood, metal, and plastics. We've got our art class. We've got a theater section, and we have Spanish and computers. So our seventh graders get one quarter of four of those classes. So they get a little bit of exposure to everything. Eighth graders are year-long electives, so they get a deeper exposure to those classes. Right now, our shop class is huge. Our kids, it's always great to go in there right before the holiday season because they're all building gifts. And the level of creativity in that shop class is just outstanding. We had a student who was making a one of our students who was on Shark Tank. You may have seen her recently. Andrea Stout was making a hat holder that she had designed, and they were horseshoe-shaped blocks of wood that she had stuck on a post. So you turn your cowboy hat upside down so the rim is rested in the cowboy, or the horseshoe shape. Absolutely ingenious. I thought, okay, that's brilliant. Some lovely Adirondack chairs that I would have paid a small fortune for that just looked beautiful. But amazing products coming out of that wood shop all the time. We've got an art class that does both pencils, paints, ceramics, a little bit of everything. And then we've got our band and choir courses that are year-long courses. For clubs and electives, we have a makerspace that takes place after school. And, Jim, about how many people do we have coming to that? 20 to 30 kids in our shop class. Mr. Nett helps out. We've got Mr. Pearson, who's our shop teacher, who's helping out on a regular basis in there. And kids can come in and they can build whatever they want once they've been trained how to use the shop safely. If we can click, I'll try to click it. And we've got a robotics club that started off in our makerspace club that's kind of taking on a life of its own. Last year they had one robot. This year we've bought a second robot and a playing field for it. There's a competition coming up next weekend that we're working on getting kids to. Started off just as an idea of, hey, we have some kids who'd like to build a robot too. Hey, we've got some parents who will actually run it as a club, and let's get it moving forward. If we can click. We have a coding club that just officially started today. So one of our teachers is teaching students how to code. It started off with Scratch programming, which a lot of students did during their hour of code. the group of kids that she's put together are bored with Scratch already. They're ready to move on. And one of the kids looked at me today and said, we're going to learn JavaScript. I said, you go right ahead. And the teacher said, yeah, they're going to go right ahead. And then we're having a Minecraft club. Our district has opened up some space on our server. This is an educationally based Minecraft server that ties into their social studies curriculum. That the same teacher who's running the coding club is going to be running our Minecraft club. So those are the things that we're currently doing in our system right now. So we can go to the next one. As we move forward, one of the things that we'd like to see is those students who aren't in a particular elective have more opportunity to do some of these project-based learning activities. So we're looking at how do we, as a staff, how do we incorporate more STEAM into our core classes. So these are some things that we've done this year that have either been cross-curricular or are a result of just one of our class. If we start in the bottom right-hand corner, our art teachers, Nancy Bedrigan, who's absolutely fantastic when the e-modernari, or whatever it's called now, was going on, she decided she was going to take her art students out of the classroom and have them create their own chalk art around the school. Surprisingly, those chalk art pieces lasted a lot longer than the ones downtown because the students were wildly respectful of them. Even though they were right in the middle where everybody lets out, students walked around them. Kids took pictures with them. It was fantastic. We had our band just do their concert. We're shooting for 100 students in our band, and this year I think we're at about 70 students right now. So last year I think we had 50. This year we have 70. We're shooting for 100 next year. We'd like to have 50 in our 7th and 50 in our 8th. Christine Carlin, who's our home economics teacher, has been a huge proponent of getting STEAM into all classrooms and really working with other teachers to be cross-curricular. The bottom left there is food art that she made with her students. That's a carrot on a potato with a the topper is a green pepper and a little parsley down there around the grass in the bottom. That was just one of several food art decorations that she had done. She also had her students do, and some of the board members that came through on the boardwalk the other day saw students working on their pajamas that they make in home ec. They actually made their pattern from a list of instructions. This tied directly into their unit on ratio and proportion that they were doing in their math classes. So students had to create their own pajama pattern based on instructions that they had found on the internet about how to size their pajamas. And then we happened to have pajama day on the Friday right before winter break. All of their pajamas were turned in on time. Our science classes do the mousetrap car every year, so that's a good STEAM project that takes place within the classroom. That's our Cyber Lancers logo that has actually been turned into a more professional-looking logo. That was the original. We've cleaned it up a little bit. It's going to be on their T-shirts. And then the upper right is something that just happened right before break. That was two of our social studies teachers decided they were going to work together and have their classes as a culminating unit create stop-motion videos to represent what they had learned about Africa in their Africa unit. So this is two kids from each class working together to create a stop-motion video. They could use Legos. They could use paper that they had done, they could use themselves. It was wildly creative and a little bit chaotic for about 2 weeks there, but their videos came out fantastic. They just graded them the other day, and they all were very proud of them. If we can go to the next one. So to kind of piggyback on what Kyle was talking about, our staff has been looking at what do we do as we move forward with STEAM. And what we're really looking at is we want to hang on to our electives because we have fantastic facilities in which to do our electives. It would be a shame to get rid of those. We've got great teachers running those classes, but we really want to be bringing more of that cross-curricular mentality into the classroom. How do we give more kids an opportunity to create something in their core areas? So we're looking at ways to incorporate STEAM into all of our subject areas while maintaining our electives, because anything we add is going to take away from someone else. So it's trying to find that balance of how do we give kids a richer experience without taking away the experiences that they already have. One of the possibilities that we're looking at is designing a schedule with semester-long electives so our eighth graders can have a little more variety. Mostly, though, we're looking forward, as we move forward, that STEAM is a philosophy of the school that we have to incorporate into everything that we teach rather than being a particular program that we're teaching. So we don't have kids who are taking STEAM classes. Every class is a STEAM class. We've got kids who are taking specialty classes within that STEAM philosophy. Thank you. Questions? Thoughts? Thank you. And I get to introduce Leslie O'Connor, who hopefully will have better luck with the technology.
Probably not. Thank you.
Thank you for having me here this evening. When we started the STEAM conversation this year at San Luis Obispo High School with our instructional cabinet, with our staff, and when you think of the teachers that we have at San Luis High, it became pretty evident that we've been doing STEAM for a long period of time at San Luis High without actually thinking about calling it STEAM. The teachers quickly realized that it's good teaching, and we're really focusing on getting students to think. And when we talk about the three R's and we think about the R being relevancy, we've seen throughout the years with like a Jeff Limkill or a Jed Brewington or a Tim Fay or a Anna Bates, Jody Evans, Jan Fetcho, you know, Kate Stevens in theater, providing relevant opportunities for our students to show that deep level of thinking and to connect the learning with, as Kyle and Kim talked earlier about, the 21st century skills that they really need. When we sat as an administrative team earlier last week, the principals and with Kim, and we talked about doing this presentation to the board with regard to STEAM, I went back to the school site and I met with our TNN team, which provides our TNN news every single day, group of students with a teacher, and they provide that live broadcast to about 1,500 students and staff every single day, created by students. And I met with them on Tuesday of last week, and I said, you know, next Tuesday night I have to do this board presentation. We're going to talk about STEAM. And since we're in football season and the Ducks didn't win last night, I suggested to them, think about those commercials that you see on TV while bowl games are going on or basketball games are going on, where they're trying to advertise maybe a Pac-12 and the collage of schools that you have in the Pac-12 or a particular university, let's just say Notre Dame as an example, and they show this 30-second video of what does it look like, why you should pay big money to come to our school, and why you should pay big money to be a member of our conference. So that was the frame. Nothing more, nothing less. The students quickly went to YouTube, looked at some of those kinds of commercials, and the video that we're hopefully going to watch was finished and pretty much created by a freshman student, one freshman student, and I watched him work today for about 30 minutes, and I was just literally in awe of how quickly he could do what he was doing. And it's not perfect, but it's a work in progress. But it was also interesting to watch the dynamic between A, the principal, and B, the teacher who runs the class, while we stood back and just watched a 14-year-old do this. And as he said, well, do you want me to move this and put this here, and what do you want here? And he was correcting, and he really struggled with us because we were trying to put our two cents in, and he just really wanted us to go away so he could create some. So I'm hoping it's going to come out pretty well. Go for it.
At San Luis High, STEAM is not our future, it's our reality. In Jeff Limkill's auto shop, or Tim Fay's metal shop, or Brewington's wood shop, we have the epitome of makerspace in action. Project-based learning in our animal vet science classes, in 12th grade advanced placement English classes, students create their own TED Talks. Senior student John Roberts recently created the Slow High ASB website from scratch. Come View, the TNN broadcast overseen by Mrs. Jones, where students take pivotal roles and responsibilities during a live broadcast to over 1,500 students and staff. Come View, our art department with Mrs. Balkman and Sands in the ceramics classes, our Tiny Tigers and home economics. And finally, watch Jan Fetcho as she motivates students to expand their knowledge of robotics and technology. We continue to develop cross-collaboration between departments, and it is our responsibility to continue the cultivation process of STEAM at San Luis High.
Now, again, that was created by a freshman student, Grant, a wonderful young man. But the question is, where do we go from here? We must be, and we're working on being much more intentional in our conversations with our staff. How do we get that cross-collaboration? How do we get that organic push? I was meeting with Jody Evans and Anna Bates today, two fabulous teachers in our ag department, and they were remarking on how they have witnessed that organic cross-collaboration taking place now at our school. We're starting to see conversations take place between math teachers and science teachers and science teachers and industrial arts teachers. They're not really working in silos. There's collaborative questions and inquiries going on about how they can establish projects. As an example, Tim Fay students prior to winter break, to raise funds for their metal shop club, went around and solicited
members of our staff who might want to buy a fire pit, and they would basically design the fire pit from scratch, build the fire pit to specs, and then they would be reimbursed for the fire pit. So here were students who were designing the fire pit in one section of his shop, moving it along to students in another section of the shop, and they're also working with math teachers and the specifics of how they design that. So we're seeing that as the next step. We have a multitude of electives at our school site, as you well know. The question for us will be, how do we tie that into our core academic and to make sure that all of our students understand what they're doing already falls within that umbrella of STEAM. So thank you. Any questions for all of us or any of us?
Right. And that's the end of the presentation? Okay, so at this time we need to open it up to the public to see if anyone has anything to wants to address this topic. Seeing none, we'll bring it back to the board. Mr. Unger.
So, Kyle, I have a question for you. You helped initiate the sixth grade program at Los Osos Middle School, which I think is highly successful. And now you're at the high school, and you said that next year, well, actually, I guess tomorrow, you're really going to start rolling out your plan. How are you guys, though, articulating that with the middle school and the seventh graders who will be eighth graders next year and then into Morro Bay High School, what, in 2016?
16, 17.
So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the team, our focus all along, it's a pleasure to have a target date. So we know that at our doorstep at the start of the 16-17 school year is a cadre of then sixth graders, then new to us ninth graders, that will have a new set of pedagogy that they've experienced and a new toolkit that they'll be working with. A part of our plan that we're going to discuss tomorrow is a foundations level ninth grade course in STEAM. And it's an articulated course, kind of like the toolkit that Andre talked about. I like that name for that, which we did not use, that Andre created at Loam's this year. But it's expanding that toolkit and just reemphasizing the level of skill sets and safety. So as we've heard tonight, there's a sixth grade level of coding, which you might call Scratch. There's also JavaScript, which is also maybe an 11th grade level of coding. So in any other subject, whether it be reading or mathematics, there's a first grade level mathematics and there's an 11th grade level of math. And the same goes for STEAM. So what we expect is by 16-17, we have the next year and a half, which I'm very happy about, that we will have a comprehensive plan that we can start building on, doing the professional development, so that when we have those kids show up in 16-17, we will be prepared with them to keep that program rolling that started at the middle school. And I'm sure I'll have an opportunity to come and I'll want to come and share the details of that program. So,
Mr. Buckman.
Thank you. I'm so excited to see this and the spread of it. It's I can't think of a good term to use like Andy, but it's crawling all over the district, maybe. Is my understanding that Kacha was coming to visit in November? Had that been finalized? Not finalized. Okay. So I just thought we might want to get the date and time out there, but we'll keep working on it.
Dr. Prater?
Yeah, I've been contacted by Kacha's Kevin, and he said that Kacha would love to come out and acknowledge the STEAM program out on the coast at Los Osos and sort of be a part of the conversation at the transition to the high school at Morro Bay High.
Great. And Mr. Unger?
Yeah, and I do know that the day that Mr. Millar and I were at Pacific Beach, Congresswoman Capps was there, and so they had an opportunity to show the program off at to her as well. It was really exciting.
Anyone else? I'd like to thank you for this presentation. It's been very informative and exciting. It's great to see all these wonderful things going on at all the sites and to see the collaboration occurring. It's very hopeful. Thank you very much for coming.
Go home.
Yeah. So next we have 9.0.
03, the science curriculum progression, grades K through 12.
So I wanted to spend some time this evening talking to you about next generation science standards and the changes that are coming related to science. So currently we're using science standards that are 15 to 20 years old. So when you think about the changes that have occurred, I looked up a couple of things. You know, NASA's landed a rover on Mars, where DVDs are now used for digital storage. Apple created an iPhone. An amputee used nerve signals to operate robotic limbs. French doctors performed a face transplant. The Hubble Space Telescope observed the first planet outside our solar system. Pluto's been reclassified as a dwarf planet. And maybe the best, Six Flags created the fastest wooden roller coaster, traveling at 72 miles an hour. So, you know, we've had a little bit of progress happening in science since these 1990 standards. So with the new Next Generation Science Standards, they're really aiming to teach students to think critically, and a lot of the things that you heard within the STEAM update, to really focus on 21st century skills. There's been a big addition of emphasis on engineering as well as Earth space standards. So Amy and I would like to focus tonight on some perspective. I can do it now, maybe. Thanks. So some changes have happened at the national level. 26 states collaborated on this project to create new K-12 standards. So they're similar to what you heard about math. There's new content standards as well as new practices. So that's a lot of what you hear similar to the STEAM components. It's really similar to the math practices of how we expect students and teachers to do their business. It was released in April 2013, and at the state level, the State Board of Education adopted that in September, and they just started in April 2014 with a state implementation plan. So we are looking at kind of a four-year rollout of these standards. So we're starting to think about, right now we're in an awareness phase. So we've outlined some important concepts that need to happen this year and then have moved that forward, kind of backwards mapping, when we know we need to assess in 17-18 and then looked backward to think about what we need to accomplish. So thinking about this year, we have formulated a Next Generation Science Standards Steering Committee that's made up of elementary, middle school, high school teachers, and some administrators to begin to wrap our mind around where are we going with this and what do we need to do to accomplish this task. We're beginning to develop an implementation plan and also including STEAM as part of that plan. We're beginning to build some district understanding and also some teacher leadership and capacity for what are we looking at when it comes to these new science standards. We're beginning to analyze our standards and further understand not just the content shifts, but the practices that are different. We're starting to explore what resources are out there to help us with this project, just like we found SVMI with math, and that's been an incredible resource for us. We're looking to see, is there a similar science resource that can really help us with professional development and increasing our own learning and capacity. We are beginning to look for model programs. Are there great things out there that we can learn from? Develop a professional development plan and explore partnerships like Cal Poly and other resources around us. So in the transition phase, what we're looking at for next year is starting a limited pilot of Next Generation Science Standards, starting at kind of a lesson or unit level that would incorporate the assessment information that we have. Aligning our current materials, and then the next step, obviously, looking for new resources. We need to look at a budget analysis and decide, you know, as the standards are calling for more modeling and really current use of resources, we need to look to see what do we need to purchase in order to make sure science instruction is, replicating what true scientists are using. We need to formally adopt the standards, so we'll be coming back to you with that and begin some professional development with the partnerships, hopefully, that we create. After that, it will be in 16-17 piloting some aligned units, piloting hopefully an assessment that we don't know much about yet at all, but we're hoping that is in place. Reviewing materials, they're saying at that point we might have resources to adopt, and then finally a full implementation and administering the assessment. So the reason I'm up here and kind of hogging the microphone from Amy is because when it comes to middle schools and high schools, there's some pressing things that we really need to look at and make some decisions on quickly. So with the middle school, we've really been looking at the pros and cons of the two models that are there. There's one called a preferred integrated model, and then there's also a traditional sequence of discipline-specific courses. So with the middle school teachers, we've been looking at what's the best decision for us and which one of those do we need to choose in order to move forward. Also, we've looked at creating a new ninth grade science course. Currently, students enter in the ninth grade into an integrated science course that is not A to G accepted. And so we're looking at creating a UCCSU approved course that helps us point in the right direction for next-gen science standards. And just this afternoon, actually, I met with a great group of teachers that are hungry to create a fantastic course and applying for A to G approval. And it's a real collaborative effort with SLO High and Morobe High there. So I know when I look at the people sitting at the table that it'll be a great course that looks at the standards that NextGen's asking and then going for approval for a Lab D UC approval. And then we're also looking at what changes to instruction and curriculum and assessment can we start embracing right now so that we can start understanding the direction that we're headed. So that is kind of a summary of NextGen Science Standards. Do you have any questions?
First, we need to see if anyone from the public would like to speak on this topic. Seeing none, we will now bring it back to the board. Sergeant Beth Rogers.
Thank you. Ms. McGrath, could you give us some specifics about how the ninth grade class will be different from what is currently being taught?
Yeah, great point. So currently, you have to look at the content shifts and then also the shifts in practices. So I know it's kind of a lot to take in all at once, but the teachers right now are looking at what are the components that NextGen is asking for students to incorporate into a ninth grade course. So some of the major differences will be the incorporation of engineering standards mm-hmm. as well as Earth space standards. And then one of the big changes is in order to be accepted as a lab science, there needs to be a heavy lab component where students use discovery and inquiry and dive into lab, and then at a high level of rigor that also incorporates the practices. So it's the shifting content, the addition of lab, and then the science practices, which are a lot of those 21st century skills, inquiry, collaboration, critical thinking, problem solving.
And do we have the facilities available at all three high schools to do those labs?
Measure D will be a huge help with that, I believe. In the meantime, there are materials, I believe, that will really help teachers that we will need to look at, kind of beefing up what they need to, create a great course. But I think our facilities are adequate, and we will look forward to what it can be.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Unger, then Mr. Quesenberry, then Mr. Buckman.
I know one of the questions has been, what do we do with ag science? How's that all fit in together?
Yeah, we have ag teachers at the table, so they're very much part of the conversation, and they're looking at how can this course also be incorporated with ag. They feel comfortable that they can incorporate it. We're looking at creating a course that is an integrated lab science course and an ag lab science course, and the ag teachers feel confident that they'll be able to create that. And our goal is to really create two course options so that ag can try to pull kids that are passionate about science in that format. So that's kind of our goal, is to create an interest in these areas and let students go into the ag program that have that passion.
Hey, Mr. Quesenberry.
Do you foresee any conflict between making this an A through G UC CSU requirement and the the new generation science standards?
You know, I was really pleased to see that the UCCSU system has actually already adapted their approval process to mirror what's expected in next-gen science standards. Was a little surprised by that. When I looked to see before going over the expectations with the teachers today, a teacher had sent me and said, hey, look, you know, they've already changed. So they are actually measuring the adoption process by those eight science practices. So it's really, I was really hopeful of that, because I was concerned that we were going to be creating this progressive great class that's headed towards where we need to go, and yet we were going to be judged by, you know, old standards. But they've already made the shift as well. So I'm excited about everyone being in alignment there.
So am I. Thank you.
Mr. Buckman.
Hi. I have a two-part question. I'm really excited about this, going to the A to G. As we look, and what I heard you say is we've got this team together. They're going to be very excited about creating a course. My question is, I think you probably are already, but just to check, other districts, other counties, other state committees or commissions giving us any guidelines on that, or are we going to really be going from ground zero to what, A and G?
Yeah, good question. We did have a team of people attend the National Science Conference here recently, and so that helped us have some state and national direction. Every district, though, is in a little different place. Some people already have A to G courses that are accepted. Some people have an Earth class, and some districts have where you choose Earth or biology and that kind of thing. The teachers and administrators all felt pretty strongly that we want that A to G opportunity for each student walking in, and don't want to start to track and create two different paths and have those kind of options. We want A to G for each ninth grader walking in. So there are some resources, there are some guides, there are some courses that are already A to G accepted that we can, you know, try to tap into. One of the teachers today said, I'll start calling those schools and see if we can find any resources. But, yeah, we're looking to see what's out there and what can be a help to us. And then, you know, we've got great people at the table to make it great for us, too.
Sounds good. Just to follow up, there's this push on CTE. And is the sense that these new standards and the alignment and the classes that you're going to be creating will be able to accommodate CTE? Are they built into it, or are we going to have to come up with something else?
Yeah, so right now we're looking at going for just a straight lab science D course. But there was talk at the table about how are we going to incorporate project-based and STEAM, and what is this going to look like within this course? How are we going to point that the right direction? There was also talk at the table about wouldn't it be neat to work with career tech electives and to create some cross-curricular courses. So, yeah, that's definitely be considered by everyone at the table.
Okay, anyone else? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks. All right, I'm hearing from some colleagues up here that they would like to take a break. So we will take a 10-minute break. Please be back on time. Thank you. Laura, is this an appropriate time to reconvene the meeting?
Yes.
All right, thank you.
I will stop my chronometer.
Okay. We are at 9.04 UC CSU eligibility, grades 9 through 12. Okay. You ready?
Yes. Thank you. Tonight I'd like to share with you graduation as well as UCCSU data. You do also have printed hard copies of the data, two-sided, one for each of our comprehensive high schools. So first, I just want to give you a quick reminder about what does it mean when we're talking about UCCSU A to G requirements. So you do have the A to G is actually A, B, C, D, E, F, G. So when you're looking at A, you're talking about your history and social science requirements, which are 2 years. And you can read there, English 4, Math at 3, although they recommend 4. Lab science, like we were just talking about, that there's 2 years required there. Language other than English,
visual and performing arts in college prep. It's also important to remember that it's not only that a student is enrolled in an A to G course, but they also need to earn a grade of C or better in order to stay UC-CSU eligible. So you have to remember both components. On one hand, we're working to increase and to make sure we tighten up any courses that are not A to G approved, but then there's also a bit in the student's hands that they need to earn a C or better in order to be A through G eligible. Absolutely.
I'm sorry. Madam Chair. So down on F, when you go back, and it's the visual and performing arts, it's my understanding now that the you can now get replace that with like an ROP-type class or a career technology class, that a district can choose to do that. And I think we explored that for a while, or the question was asked, but I just think that we ought to just remember that.
Acknowledge that. Yeah, thanks. Good point. So we will move on. We'll begin with Morro Bay. And Aaron did a fantastic job of creating this data for you. So if you want to start at the top of the blue side of the page, then Aaron will walk you through the data. Thanks.
Okay. All right. So, starting with the cohort graduation rate, the cohort graduation rate was first calculated for the class of 09-10. And I wanted to explain that to you. We've talked about it just one or two times. It's a fairly new way of calculating the graduation rate. So, what we do now is it's creating a cohort based on who's enrolled at our schools in the ninth grade. Then their data follows us, regardless of where they end up in the 12th grade, and is calculated in our graduation rate. So this number for 12-13 represents all of the students that were freshmen at Morro Bay High in 09-10, and then went on, most of which, to graduate from Morro Bay High School, but also might be now at Pacific Beach High School or at other high schools in California. So for Morro Bay's data, we see that overall the graduation rate is pretty high. If we compare it to the state and the county, we're about 10% above the county and about 20% above the state. And if we look at the subgroups or our different student groups, we experience virtually no achievement gap in 2012-13 for our socioeconomically disadvantaged students and our English learners. I did want to note here that the English learner number includes our foreign exchange students and our students who are English learners in high school. So if you're an English learner in high school, most likely you're newer to the United States and you're still in English support classes. For the most part, all of our English learners are in the elementary grades, and then as they progress, they are redesignated. So this number is a small group of students, as we'll see in some of the data later, and I'll give you a number. So it's more likely to fluctuate up and down when there's only 5 or 12 students in that group. Okay. All right, so the next piece of data I have for you is Morro Bay High, their UCCSU data by subject. So overall, we see that 52% of the class of 2014 met all of the 7 A through G requirements. But if we break it down by subject, we see that a far greater percentage do finish A through G requirements in visual and performing arts and electives. The core subjects is where it still hovers around that 50% mark. And as Kim mentioned earlier, this could be due to them not taking A through G coursework in these areas or not completing the course with a C or better. So as we saw in the last slide, about half, and if we look over time, it's still about half of Morro Bay High School students complete A through G requirements, which then qualifies them to apply to UCs and CSUs, our four-year state college and universities.
And if we look at our student groups, EL, about 28% of the class of 2013-14 met these results, so we see it trending upward a little bit, but again, that's a really mixed group of foreign exchange students and very new students to the United States. For socioeconomically disadvantaged, we see especially a really strong showing for the class of 13-14 with 40% of students meeting A through G requirements. And then Morro Bay has a very established AVID program. One of the goals of AVID is for students to be eligible to apply for four-year colleges and universities. So the strength of this program over time is seen in the data where 93% of the students that are enrolled in AVID still in 12th grade are meeting those UCCSU requirements.
Is there an overlap of any of those students that, because there used to be some students that were still designated EL that would be in AVID? I mean, they were like fairly high level, level four, level five.
There could be.
There could be, okay.
Mm-hmm. And as well as with socioeconomically disadvantaged, a student could potentially be in all of those three groups. Okay. And then the next piece of data, we started tracking this a couple of years ago. We joined the National Student Clearinghouse Student Tracker, and they provide member schools and districts with data on what happens after they graduate. Where do our kids go? 96% of the universities and colleges in the United States are represented by and are in this group of data. So, if we look at this data, overall, kind of big picture, 75% of Morro Bay High School students enroll in some kind of post-secondary institution after graduating within the first 2 years of graduating from high school. Most of them attend public two-year in-state universities. But there is a trend. At Morro Bay High, we see more students starting to attend four-year colleges as well. So with the class of 2012, 40% enrolled in a two-year university and 30% enrolled in a four-year university. Yeah, I think we're in discussion.
And so that's of the 68% of the class of 2012 that enrolled in either a public or a private college,
this is
right?
Out of total class of 2012. So out of the class of 2012, 70% enrolled somewhere.
Right.
40% of that was at two-year and 30% at four-year. The other 30% were not accounted for. And so in the next slide, that piece of data may be a little more clear. And I'll take this piece by piece. So if we look at the post-secondary progress of the class of 2008. So in 2008, in June, these students graduated. And then that following fall, in year one, we saw that 75% enrolled in college and 25% were not in the database. The reason we don't say that that's 25% didn't enroll is because there is that small chance that they enrolled in those 4% of institutions that aren't in the database, or that their data just didn't match up. They spelled their name a little bit differently, or they didn't want their data reported, something like that. So we do know that 75% of the class of 2008 in the first year out of high school enrolled at a post-secondary institution. Then if we follow them in year two.
Ellen, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Would you mind? Just going back to that first where you said 75 mm-hmm. and 25, and the comment about 75 did enroll and 25 didn't enroll, is there a chance that those some of that 25% went into the trades?
Yep.
Okay. So,
yeah.
So that's,
and there's a chance that they went into some other kind of, like even the Army or something like that.
Okay.
But
so
didn't enroll in an academy or at a college or university.
Just, okay.
Yeah.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. That's so that's why we don't say they didn't enroll anywhere. We just say they're not in the database. But in order to keep tracking them, we kind of have to keep that number there. So we can see that in year two, that number gets even smaller. So over time, we see that kids enroll somewhere
that then does pop up in the database. So year two, we see that 65% of students are still enrolled, 6% more have now enrolled that weren't enrolled before, and 2% have graduated, I surmise, with a two-year associate's degree somewhere. And then we see that that 8% is students that were enrolled in the first year but are no longer enrolled in the second year. So as we follow their data in years 3, 4, 5, and 6, we see that after year 6, so now we're in after last spring, 37% of the class of 2008 has earned a degree at a post-secondary university or college. So they might have earned an associate's degree, a bachelor's degree, a master's degree. It could be any of those things. 20% are still enrolled at a post-secondary institution. And then about a third had at one time enrolled but did not earn a degree. So it's fairly complicated data, but I hopefully broke it down for you. Are there any questions about that one? I'll let you mull it over. We'll see it again with Slow High. And then this is probably my favorite slide to share. So for Morobe High School, of all of the classes we've submitted, the class of 2007 through the class of 2014, here's where they went. So most students do enroll in Cuesta College, but we also see three UCs on this list, UC Santa Barbara, UC Santa Cruz, and UC Davis, and seven CSUs. Cal Poly, San Francisco State, Sonoma State, CSU Monterey Bay, Humboldt State, Chico State, and San Diego State as well. So if we flip it over to the black and gold side, here we have Slow High. So Slow High also has a very high graduation rate, and there's really no noticeable gaps for most years. In 11-12, there was a little bit more of an achievement gap, but it did rebound in 12-13. And again, with these groups, it's very small numbers of students, so we do see those fluctuations up and down. And then if we look at A through G requirements by subject area, so overall, 69-70% of students at Slow High meet all seven A through G requirements. Again, much higher numbers for visual performing arts and electives. So that's 1 year of a CSU UC approved visual performing art and 1 year of an additional elective class. Most students meeting that requirement, and then less students meeting those core area requirements. And again, that could be due to not being in a UC CSU approved course or not earning a C or better in that course. And so if we look at their data for their student groups, over time, we see that over 60% and then now moving towards 70% of students meet UC CSU requirements. English learners at a much lower rate. I failed to mention earlier, English learners at this level, many of them are still in ELD, an ELD course. Our current ELD course is not UC CSU approved. We are working, and Kim is working on that actually presently, to get that course UC CSU approved. And that would then make them eligible in English, at least, that they could actually earn the credits to become eligible to apply for those four-year colleges and universities. And then SED, right around a third of socioeconomically disadvantaged students at Slow High meet all A through G requirements upon graduating. Their AVID program was not in these first 2 years fully implemented, so we didn't have 12th graders in AVID, and they're still working to fully implement it so that, like we saw with Morro Bay, their numbers started out similar to this, and then their trajectory ended at 93%, so Slow High is hoping to move towards that as well. If we look at their student tracker data,
we see about 85% of SLO High students enroll in post-secondary institutions within the first 2 years of graduating from high school. About the majority, again, go to in-state California public institutions, but they're about 50-50 with two-year, four-year. So actually, class of 2012, they have 43% attending a four-year and 41% attending a two-year college or university. There's also a trend at SLO High of students attending more private and out-of-state institutions as well. So then if we look at the class of 2008, 81% of them in that first year enrolled in a college or university, and then 19% were unaccounted for. And as we said earlier, that can mean a variety of things. And then in year two, 73% of those were still enrolled, 2%, the exact identical percent as Morro Bay, had earned a degree, 4% were still enrolled, and 6% were no longer enrolled. So then if we look at their progression to year six, about half of students that attend SLO High earned a degree within 6 years of graduating for the class of 2008, and 15% were still enrolled. And then about a quarter had enrolled at one point but did not earn a degree.
I have a math question, may I?
Yep.
So I'm trying to figure out just what the four-year graduation or still-in-school rate is for both high schools. And using that graph, what I came up with is for SLO High School, 49% had graduated after 4 years, 15% were still enrolled. So we
after
can assume that, that they would be. So that's about a 64% still either had completed four-year or were still pursuing a four-year degree.
It could be any degree.
Okay.
Right. So at mm-hmm. some point, if we look at year six, at some point 90% of the class of 2008 has enrolled somewhere, 90%, and then 49%. So, yeah.
So we don't have a four-year, our only four-year completion data is the 49%. Do we have anything that measures what percentage of our students
Earn
graduate?
A four-year degree?
A four-year degree, yes.
This is a two or a four-year degree. We don't have
So we don't know that.
So when it says still enrolled at year six,
mm-hmm.
Could it mean that they're working on an advanced degree at that point, that they had received
They're not double counted in that number, so if they've earned a degree, they would be counted in the earned a degree category.
Okay, so if they remain in school and are working on an advanced degree, they drop off of...
Yeah, they're already counted in that 49.
Okay, mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Can I ask a question? Do we at some point break this down by the subgroups? So do we look at... Is it possible at any point to look at whether English language learners or socioeconomically disadvantaged students are attending college as well? We have the data for whether they're taking the A to G requirements, but do we know what their enrollment patterns look like?
Great question. So this is about our third year tracking this data, and we had not submitted socioeconomically disadvantaged data, so we're looking into retroactively doing that so that we can do that. And then for English learners, we have to pull them out by hand and then recalculate it. But we're looking at how we can better start tracking also our student groups with this data. And so, I'll wait.
I do have another question regarding that. So do we know how, going back to our four-year graduation completion, so that would make Morro Bay High School in the 37% range and SLO High in the 49% range, is that correct?
Yeah, yes. For any degree.
Any degree. Oh, any degree, two or four?
Yes.
Year? Okay, and do we know how that compares with similar schools throughout the state, high schools?
That is a really good question. I will get back to you on that.
Okay.
The state did finally start tracking this data. So we got last spring, we got the first
blush at this data. Mm-hmm. I don't have the exact numbers with me now, but when we looked at our data at that time, it was favorable, but we can get back to you on that.
Great. And that, the only reason for asking that would be to set a target for ourselves of mm-hmm. what we would like to accomplish.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
And then last slide, so for Slow High, the classes of 2007 through 2014 combined, most students do attend Cuesta College, but also here we see six UCs and four CSUs represented in their top 15. And Ken's going to wrap it up for us, but I'll stay right here. They're still puzzling.
So it is a lot of data to take in at once. So I want to kind of wrap up some of the summary points that stuck out to us. We have a very high graduation rate, and we also have little to no achievement gap between our subgroups and all students. So when it comes to graduation, doing excellent. Overall, about 59% of our students meet A to G requirements. Students are completing visual performing arts and elective at a very high rate. Most students tend to attend public in-state in either a 2 or 4 year college. The majority of students do begin their coursework for post-secondary at a local community college. For our entire district, the top 15 schools of attendance, it does include 5 UCs and 6 CSUs. On average, about 81% of our students attend a post-secondary institution within 2 years of graduating. And for that class that we were looking at, 2008, 6 years after graduation from high school, I think we just talked about this, 44% graduated with a degree, 17% are still enrolled. So that concludes our graduation and UCCSU data. Any final questions?
Well, I think this is great data, and my understanding is that it's going to be even more important as we get into the new APIs when graduation data start, and I'm not sure if A to G requirements will become part of that, but I think these are both things that we'll be judged by in the future rather than just the standardized test scores. We're really going to have to start paying attention to this stuff, and so thank you for this information.
Thanks, Ed. MiraQuest is great data gathering, and I'm sure it's a little difficult, so I appreciate it. A lot of families are not familiar with what the requirements are for UCCSU, and so they might, my kid's in high school, he's doing great, he's got A's, and then get to the senior year and go, but he can't go to a state school. So how important or at what point do we start counseling parents and talking about A to G requirements? Because without that, a lot of our families are just not going
to
know.
Yeah, you're right. It is a bit of a foreign language to try to navigate. So counselors do class presentations, meet with small groups, and meet with individuals in order to help them understand the A to G requirements. Also, just to put out, we did purchase Naviance, which counselors are really excited about, which is a fantastic communication tool so that families can work together as a team with counselors and their students in order to create a 6-year plan for their students so that they can better understand and keep track of where they are and help them to navigate that system and create a really seamless communication tool. So we're hoping that that's another great way for people to thoroughly understand what the requirements are, but then also where their student specifically stands.
Okay, so if I can just frame that, because it just came to my mind, just frame that slightly differently. When we talk to parents, and their students are usually present, does every parent get an understanding of what it takes to get to a UC, a CSU? Do they all understand that they need these specific classes?
Absolutely.
Great. Thank you very much.
If I can just add a comment, one of the takeaways that I get from all of this data is that we do a fantastic job of graduation rate. Our kids graduate from high school. It's never been an issue in San Luis Obispo. We have a very low dropout rate. But what we have to continue to pay attention to is not necessarily the number of A through G courses we offer. We offer plenty. But it's what happens when the student doesn't pass that first class? What are we doing to recover those credits? Because right now, those students might get those credits through an online program that isn't A through G approved. They may just carry that D and never remediate that. They may not get to the Algebra 2 level, which is the level you must achieve in order to get to a UC A through G. So I think for us, what we need to look at is the kind of the recovery of those credits, because I think these numbers will improve if we can figure out the best way to pay attention to those students who falter in their ninth grade year or their 10th grade year and never get back on track. That's our target.
And are we following along with what happens with what choices our Pacific Beach students make?
Yeah, it's a great question. Unfortunately, when you have a D or an F, and you know, like Mr. Robinette just mentioned, that is, you know, an eliminator. So often when students are short in credits, that, you know, that means it's because they failed it. So we haven't specifically looked at where our PAC Beach students are, because it's kind of what got them there. You know, it's when you're short in credits, it's because you failed them, and then therefore you're not A to G eligible. But like Mr. Robinette mentioned, we are looking at, are there credit recovery options that are A to G so that we can try to hold on to more and more students.
Okay.
And then the student tracker data, we actually can, I can get you that this week for PB.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I'd be interested in, I guess it, I don't want to think that because a student ends up at, you know, for whatever reason, at Pacific Beach, that those doors are just closed.
Yeah, the two-year door, the going into a two-year institution is still open. The majority of students may have lost UCCSU eligibility or okay. Four-year right away, but still would have the opportunity to get there after a two-year.
Right, so I would be interested to know how many PB students, are, as long as the rest of the board is interested in that data as well, to know how many PB students go to attend a two-year.
Yeah, I think that's the fair thing to say. Our students graduating from our continuation school or any continuation school are not going to be UCCSU eligible. They just aren't. But our hope is that most are attending a two-year program or have that. They certainly have that available, but that would be good to know.
Mr. Unger.
Yeah, and I'd just like to say, too, that I think what you said, and I think, Rick, just thinking about what you said, how important it is that we really work closely with our community colleges and with Cuesta, obviously, since the majority of our students are going to Cuesta. Students that aren't completing their A to G requirements are, you know, going to Cuesta, going to Hancock, going to other community colleges, where if they choose, they could do the 2 years there and then move on to a UC or CSU. So, you know, that focus, not completing the A to G requirements, and I'm not making excuses for this, but not completing A to G requirements does not mean a kid is a failure. It means a kid gets to go to a community college, which I'm proud of the fact I went to community college. So, yeah, I just think we need to keep looking at that as well.
Okay, Mr. Buckman?
And just, I guess, philosophically, as one board member, I understand the drive for us to look at this data and judge ourselves to some point on how many students qualify for UCCSU, but for me, at least as one board member, I'm not sure the goal of high school is to ensure that students go to college as much as we give them the tools they need to be prepared for life. And so sometimes this data is great, but it's, I don't know how we grab the other data. How many others went to trade school because they're not evidently not registered with this database? How many have become nurses through other programs? And so I think the data is great, but I just don't want to get too hung up on it in terms of this is how we judge the success of our students. Thanks.
Mrs. Rogers?
Thank you. Getting back to the counseling piece, that seems to me to be really critical. The direction and leadership that a student receives from their counselor in creating the path. And I think it's also, whether the kids like it or not, it's important to have the parents involved, too. So you were saying that there is some kind of a program, and I don't remember the name you gave to it.
Right, Naviance.
Ambiance?
Naviance with an N.
Nambiance?
Naviance.
Naviance.
There it is.
Oh, sounds like something you dab behind your ears.
You can try.
But
that.
Is that includes the student, the parents, and the counselor working in concert?
It's a web-based program, but yes, it has many different elements, and maybe we could myself or Chris Dallermite can show you about that another time, because it is really interesting. It creates a solid communication tool between the families and the school to create a real team of monitoring where the student is, and creates just a, you know, web-based tool so that all of that can be tracked and watched as a student progresses through high school.
How are students and parents made aware of the existence of that program?
Yeah, it's just teachers and counselors are just going through the training on it now, and so they're going to start a pilot of it this spring.
Okay.
And start to work and, you know, kind of work out the kinks and work on that, and then they're looking to roll it out next year.
Terrific. Thank you.
Is there anyone from the public who would like to address us about this topic?
Okay.
Seeing none, and it appears the board is done. Thank you very much for a very interesting and thought-provoking presentation. All right. Our next topic, 9.05, Developer Fee Justification Study.
So we have Julie Avenade here from Spectrum Management Solutions, who helped us with our demographic study as well as our developer fee justification study. I'm going to have her kind of talk about that process, how this works in terms of that. For the board to know, we haven't raised our rate in about 6 years, I believe. So we're currently charging $2.63 for residential, 42 cents for industrial, commercial. And so though each year the state actually re-looks at the amount that you can charge. So we've actually, in some ways, you can think that this may be kind of a big jump. However, it's actually, we've probably been giving people a benefit over the past 6 years in terms of this fee. So the current fee and the resolution that's going to be presented later in the agenda is for us to move that to the statutory level of $3.36 for residential and 54 cents for the commercial amount. So in terms of developer fees, as we talked about in the state budget, there is a proposal to possibly change that, but developer fees are used specifically for growth in terms of have to be spent on projects that are happening because of growth in the district, so like Teach Elementary School, and our need because of the growth with Bishop's Peak and to move Teach there, we were able to use developer fees for that. I'm going to go ahead and let Julie now talk about kind of what she found in that study, and then I'll finish. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. Good to see you again. I'm going to keep this short and just kind of summarize, because there's a lot of data, a lot of numbers that, and it's been a long evening already with a lot of data and numbers. So briefly, what we do in a developer fee justification study is just that, justify the square footage costs based on your cohort enrollment projections over 5 through 20 years. We take that, and then separately we try to project out with a lot of interaction information from your city, San Luis Obispo, City of Morro Bay, and the county offices of what they see coming in new developments 5 to 10 to 15 years out. What kinds of housing, whether it's, they call it single family detached, single family attached, multifamily, and there's formulas and information that we use to calculate all of that. The end result is that based on that information, the district, your district qualifies for what they call level one developer fees. And that is the $336 per square foot that was in your resolution this evening, jumping up from the $252 or whatever it was before, $260. And the commercial was 42 or 34 cents put my glasses on so I can read, was 42 going to 54 cents. That means that most of the time what that means is at the point when the developers pull permits, that's after they've gone through their tentative maps and all of that, they pull permits to build. That's when they are also required to come in and pay these fees to the districts. Those fees can be are to be used for growth-related projects. That doesn't mean, though, that it's only to build a new school, which you may need in the next, I think we were saying before, 10 to 12 years. It can also mean expanding what you have, modernizing what you have. For example, maybe you needed to add on some space onto an MPR because that school is growing by 20 kids in the next couple of years. So it's not just buying new sites and new and building a new school. It can be enhancing what you already have. So just briefly, it's the state law gives the districts the authority to charge these fees. Level one fees are adjusted every 2 years by the state or the state allocation board. It's based on an inflation rate for what they call Class B construction. And I won't get into all the nitty-gritty details of that, but Class B basically relates to basically residential homes. There is a Level 2 fee and a Level 3 fee that most districts, Level 3 has actually been, if this is the right word, outlawed until the end of this year. That was a government and a governor thing a few years back. I don't know that I've ever heard of a district that could charge level three anyway, and level three basically means that your developer would actually pay the full cost for building a new school. Level two, if you qualified for that, you could ask for more or charge more than what we're asking you to in this resolution, but you have to meet some very strict standards to do that, and you don't meet those. One of those standards includes, you know, multi-track year-round. Another one has to do with how much debt you may carry against your bonding capacity, and you don't meet those. The other reason we didn't, besides the fact that you don't meet them now, we haven't pursued those because I think, as Ryan had mentioned earlier, the governor's just pretty much dead set right now against a state school funding program. He's looking at, apparently, ways to tweak the level two and possibly the level three process for qualifying. So until we know what he's going to do, it would be a waste of time to really try to pursue that. So long story short is, you hadn't updated your developer fee justification study, and we think about 5 to 6 years. With the fact that your construction program is gearing up and you were successful with your bond, we wanted to get this in front of you so that that's just another avenue for facility funds to improve what you have and then also be able to plan ahead for what we see coming 10 to 12 years out. With any potential new school based on the projections that we had done previously.
Okay, I'd like to take this to the public first. Is there anyone here to talk about this topic? Okay, seeing none, we'll come back to the board. And I'm going to ask a question first.
Thank you.
I notice on our resolution, and this is, a procedural question, but I wanted to ask it. Now, we state that the superintendent or designee shall cause the fee to be collected prior to the issuance of a building permit. What is the, by the City of Morro Bay, San Luis Obispo, or San Luis Obispo County, what is that proceed? What do we have to put in place? Because then the next paragraph states that the resolution becomes effective 60 days after adoption by the board, and I'm wondering how those mesh, if this has to go before some sort of administrative, you know, governmental entities, and if this can all be accomplished within the 60 days.
I'll jump in. Okay. Typically, when someone comes in for a building permit to get that, they have to get a receipt from the district saying they've paid their developer fees. And so I come in with a 1,000-square-foot house. I'm paying $336, so I've got to pay my $336 fee to the district. I used to be Peggy Charlesworth, now will be
Somebody new, Julie.
Somebody new.
We write them a receipt. They go back to the city, show that receipt, and then they're issued the building permit. So we're actually the collector of the funds for that.
I see.
Yeah,
okay,
and then
so
the cities
really
know that they have to have a receipt from us saying they've paid their fees.
Okay.
Now, there is some interaction in terms of the city will, you know, send a form back to us that says they're building 1,000 square feet of square footage. You know, the estimated fee is this. So we have some behind-the-scenes contact with them, but we are the entity that collects that fee and then issues the...
Okay, and we're the final approving entity. I mean, we don't have to go elsewhere seek any additional approvals to make this happen.
No. What the city will... All they care about is getting a receipt saying that the fees are paid in full.
Okay.
In theory, they're not concerned what our number is. They just want to know that the fees have been paid that based on the square footage.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Buckman.
Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you so much for all the help that you've given us. As I was reading this, I'm so used to seeing Morro Bay and Los Osos and Baywood as our coast, and then Avila and San Luis City as a grouping. And within the report, it broke Avila out into the coast. Did that affect the numbers? Are we expecting growth in Avila? Did it change anything?
No.
It was just because it was on the coast?
Yeah.
Oh,
exactly.
Good.
Exactly. And it was outside of the city limits of the other two.
Great. Okay.
So, yeah,
thank you.
Thank you. I'm assuming that other agencies also charge development fees. Or is the school district the only one?
I believe school districts are the only ones.
Well, cities are going to have.
Cities yeah. have
mitigation
a
fees, traffic,
kind of arrangement
planning.
And they have mitigations. But I don't, to be honest, I don't know of any other, and I've never had that question, but I don't think there's any other agencies that do. Cities have their own mechanisms.
So it's just school districts. Do we know if the... other districts in our county are at their statutory limit?
We haven't worked with the other districts. I can only tell you that in the last few years, particularly when the state school building program kind of went away, more and more districts are making sure that theirs are up to date.
Okay.
But I don't have specific information about districts around you. Other than, you know, we were checking on, sometimes we do comparisons about how lots or how properties, the prices of them. But in terms of the districts and their developer fee justification studies, I don't know. I can just tell you that it's been very active the last few years because they saw the state money going away. They've got to make sure that they have everything in place otherwise that they could draw on. To take care of their
so facilities. Adjustments have been happening statewide.
Oh yes, yes. Okay. We the three of us actually. They invited me to go along with them. Went to a workshop about 2 months ago here in San Luis Obispo County Office of Education, just to see if there was anything new out there that we hadn't heard about. And it was quite heavily attended. And it was all about the districts and getting them up to speed on what the latest fees were, what the latest details were, if there was anything new in the regulations, which there wasn't anything significant, and then just kind of looking ahead at what the governor's been making noises about. And it was quite heavily attended. It was
okay.
Pretty crowded room.
Well, if I wrote my numbers down correctly, we're talking about going from 260 to 336, on residential,
mm-hmm.
and 42 to 54 on commercial?
Yes.
So then by my rough calculations here, a 2,500 square foot residential, a residential structure, at the new rate would be the additional cost to a potential home builder would be $1,900, which to me doesn't seem prohibitive in the scope of $250,000 or $300,000 to build that home. It's not a huge portion. And if you were looking at a 10,000 square foot incubator building, a commercial building, $1,200, which again I don't think is prohibitive to the builder. So just for my colleagues, that's what I calculated to be the difference in cost, yeah. On those two. Thank you very much.
I just wanted to iterate what Mr. Pinkerton and I spoke about today. As I read this, I only saw, it appeared to me that it only related to new construction or commercial construction, but as we discussed, it's as it always was and has been, if you're adding to the footprint of your house, even one addition, that will be calculated at the same rate, so for the residential or for the business. Just want to make sure everyone
understands
that.
Generally speaking, if anyone is building something new where they are required by code or whatever to pull a permit, that's when they're charged the fee. That's a very general, but that's kind of, so if you're just adding on to your house and it's a big enough, meets the minimum square footage that you are required to pull a building permit, you would be charged. And then, of course, the residential, the developers, the new houses, the new commercial buildings, anything like that. If they're adding on and they are required to pull a permit to meet code, et cetera, then they are charged these fees. The commercial, I'm sure you're aware of, the commercial has to do with, and the reason it's less is for the reason that commercial doesn't house families, but they draw families in. So there's obviously that nexus. Some way along the way, there's the chance that they're going to be bringing in kids. And so you have the right to, and by law, to charge them that amount for the commercial square footage.
Just the caveat to that is that it's non-habitable space. You build a shop that's exempt from these fees because that's not actually, you know, putting bedrooms and people in there. For example, I added onto my garage a few years ago, and there was no developer fees for that. But it's residential, the habitable component.
But Anthony, in theory, if you do work that has a greater dollar value than $150 or something, you're supposed to pull a permit for it?
You'll pull a building permit, but you won't be required to pay developer fees for some projects. Like you're going to go renovate your kitchen, and you're going to pull a building permit to renovate your kitchen and push a wall out. Maybe 15, you know, just, and something that's not adding load or, you know, occupants to the space, then it may fall under a threshold.
Okay, because I know that everybody at this table has pulled a building permit when they've changed out their water heater, mm-hmm. and
there's no developer fee for that.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's if you added a bedroom, you know, the nexus is you're adding a bedroom. You know, you may not have children, but the next buyer of your house might. So.
Anything else? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And our next agenda item is the resolution to adopt the developer fee rate increase.
I'm the next three items, so I'm just going to
okay,
stand up.
Okay, so do you want to speak about this? Or
this is just a resolution raising the fees.
Okay, great. So I would entertain a motion. Anyone? Thank you, Mr. Unger. I've been doing so well. I was hoping not to go through this. Anyone from the public wishing to address the resolution for the developer fee rate increase? Seeing none. Mr. Quesenberry.
Well, I'm going to move a resolution, but I do want to comment on Mr. Unger's comment. I mean, I still consider it flawless because you went to the public, but not just on the specific resolution. So,
I'll second the motion.
All right. So I move resolution number 06-14-15, imposing statutory mitigation fees on residential and commercial industrial development projects pursuant to Senate Bill 50.
Okay, we have a motion by Mr. Quesenberry, a second by Mr. Millar, and this will be a roll call vote, is my understanding.
Mr. Buckman?
Yes.
Dr. Eisendorf Rogers?
Yes.
Mr. Millar?
Yes.
Mr. Quesenberry?
Yes.
Ms. Roger?
Yes.
Ms. Sheffer?
Yes.
And Mr. Unger?
Yes.
All right. The next item is 10.02, having to do with resolution number 071415, certifying all proceedings in the November 4, 2014 general obligation bond election.
So Measure D passed. Yay. And so we have to actually, as a board, certify those election results. And so you have the information that Julie Roldwald, our former county clerk, gave us in terms of the election. It kind of gives a breakdown of the areas and vote and those things. So we just need the board tonight in a resolution to pass those results. And the key aspect of this vote tonight is that this does set the after the board passes the resolution, this gives us the 60 days to put together our Citizens Bond Oversight Committee.
Perfect. All right. Anyone from the public wishing to address this resolution? Seeing none, I will entertain a motion. Mr. Unger?
Well, I just wanted to say that I took a quick look at the results, and it was neat to see that I believe every precinct except for one overwhelmingly or pretty close to overwhelmingly voted yes on Measure D, and the only one that voted no had I think 22 voters in it, 12 of whom voted no and 10 of whom voted yes. Yeah. So I think we did a great job, and congratulations to the team and really to the community for passing this.
That's right.
To our students.
All right.
I'll
move it.
I'll make that motion.
All right. Thank you, Mrs. Roger.
And I'll second.
Thank you. So again, as a resolution, then we need a roll call vote.
Mr. Buckman?
Yes.
Dr. Eisendorf Rogers?
Yes.
Mr. Millar?
Yes.
Mr. Quessenberry?
Yes.
Ms. Roger?
Yes.
Ms. Sheffer?
Yes.
And Mr. Unger?
Yes.
All right. We are on a resolution roll here.
Yes.
Item 10.03, resolution number 081415. Declaring intention to reimburse expenditures from the proceeds of obligations to be issued by the district.
So, as the board's going to learn Friday about the bond process and sale and receiving funds, those types of things, we currently haven't sold any bonds and don't have any money. However, we're moving forward. We need to get projects going, hire architects and get site committees and do these things. So, we're going to the district will be, you know, having some debt because of those projects. So what this allows us to do, this resolution, allows us to basically begin that process, expend funds, and then once the bond sales actually occur, to use those future bond sales towards what we're doing currently in terms of expense. So this is a resolution that we have to actually pass, that the board has to pass, in order to be able to utilize those future bond funds on Measure D projects that we're beginning now.
And of the expenditures we will make between now and the first release, when do we anticipate the first release? So when will we pay ourselves back?
So this is going to be a product of our Friday study session, but it looks like probably April.
Okay.
Based on if the board...
So it will be a pretty short-term
good for the board, yes.
Situation.
It would be a very short-term thing. We'll, you know, so far the process has been pretty minimal in terms of expenses. You know, some of the things we've started with the Morro Bay High School pool and pool designs. But, you know, we're going to be bringing the architect's contracts and things probably at our next board meeting to begin the Slo High and Morro Bay High. So this will be something that begins to ramp up.
Okay, thank you.
Both of these resolutions were prepared by our bond council.
Great, thank you. Going to the public on this resolution. Seeing no one, we'll bring it back and we'll entertain a motion. Mr. Millar.
I asked this the other day. I just wanted to share the response. So this, by doing this, we're not going to impact our cash flow. Operational cash flow. We're not going to be taking, because we are taking funds from the general fund. We're paying some of these expenses, and then they'll be reimbursed when the bond sale goes forward, right?
We would be, but the fact that we're, you know, hopefully going to have bond funds by April, the short term, as Ms. Sheffer said, we should be fine.
Okay, great, thank you.
I have a question. Also, it was on the $177,000 maximum principal.
$177 million?
What?
Oh, there you go.
I've got that. Thank you.
Okay. Sorry.
Anyone else? And I'll entertain a motion at this time.
Never
Mr. Millar.
Approval of resolution number 81415, declaring intention to reimburse expenditures.
I'll second.
From the proceeds.
Sorry.
It's a longer title. From the proceeds and obligations to be issued by the San Luis Coastal Unified School District.
And
I'll second.
Seconded by Ms. Eisenbrath Rogers. Okay, once again.
Mr. Buckman?
Yes.
Dr. Eisenbrath Rogers?
Yes.
Mr. Millar?
Yes.
Mr. Questenberry?
Yes.
Ms. Roger?
Yes.
Ms. Sheffer?
Yes.
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, one and all. All right, we are moving on to the action consent agenda. I will read the agenda items. Please let me know if you'd like anything pulled. 11.01, approval of certificated and classified personnel items.
Could you pull up, please?
11.02, acceptance of donations. 11.03, approval of furniture and equipment requests. 11.04, approval of purchase orders. Anyone? Going, gone. 11.05, approval of warrants and payroll. 11.06, approval of quarterly report on uniform complaint filings, Williams settlement. 11.07, authorize a pass-through checking account for San Luis Obispo High School. Okay, anyone from the public wanting to speak to any of these action consent items? Okay, then I will. I would like a motion for 11.4 through 11.7.
I will make that motion.
Mr. Millar. All right. Any further discussion?
All Millar and Unger. Millar, the maker.
Sorry. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, Mr. Unger, 11.01.
Yeah. I just wanted to say that on that list was the retirement of Melissa Newman, and I would just like to wish Melissa well. Melissa was, I guess now, a longtime teacher at Pacific Beach High School, and we will certainly miss her.
I had the privilege of working with Melissa in mock trial for a number of years. She was amazing. Her ability to handle the classroom situation and motivate kids to do things at the beginning of mock trial they never imagined in their lives they could do. And she was amazing. And I wish her well in her legal career.
That's right. I think she's going to law school.
I think she's done.
Oh, wow. I'll make that motion to approve item number 11.01.
Motion by Mr. Unger, second by Mr. Millar. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, 11.02, acceptance of donations, Ms. Eisenbrath Rogers.
I just wanted to do a little shout out to the Lemons family. I see their name appears four times in this list under PG&E, and I've seen it many times in the past. And it occurred to me as I saw this that they no longer have children in the school district. And over the years, each of them have contributed so generously of their time, from booster clubs to gold and black clubs to classroom work, and so many times to this PG&E campaign. So I just wanted to thank Melanie and Lauren Lemons and the PG&E program of the Campaign for Community. And with that, I would move acceptance of 1102.
I'll second that.
Okay. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? And 11.03, approval of furniture and equipment request, Mr. Buckman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question, and Ryan and I talked just briefly today about some of the agenda, and I noticed that the PA system on this for Pacheco is set to go to the PTA, and my understanding of the process is often that the district comes to the PTA, or the site comes to the PTA, and says, we could use this, and PTA will come up with the funding. So I'm just kind of wondering how this one worked out.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it is kind of an interesting dynamic because normally you would have the PTA would donate the money to Pacheco. Pacheco would then go buy the equipment, and then it would be asset tag, those types of things. So I did talk to Karen Campbell-Bryant, our purchase agent, and basically the same thing's going to happen. It's just kind of the opposite aspect where the PTA is basically using our ability to get a cheaper price on the PA system to purchase it, and then it does get asset tagged and will end up being part of Pacheco School. So it's you may see a donation item in the future where they've donated a PA system to the district after they've purchased it through our
Thank you.
Our idea.
I'd like to make a motion to approve 11.03.
I'll second.
Okay, any further discussion? Motion made by Mr. Buckman, seconded by Mr. Quisenberry. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, that completes the action consent items. We are at 12.02, advanced agenda. Anyone have any items for the advanced agenda? Ms. Eisendrath Rogers?
In regards to the correspondence that we received from Kelsey Baker, I'm wondering if we could maybe receive something in our Friday packet addressing the Phillips 66 oil train project and what other school districts are doing or not doing in that regard. Please, thank you.
Anything else? All right.
Did we decide that
there's something in the bad board packet? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Reports by board members. Does anyone have anything to report this week? Mr. Unger?
Sure. And just a couple of things that I'd like to just talk about real quickly. The first is that yesterday I was able to go to Los Osos Middle School and see the Dancing Scientist. And he did dance, and he was really great. He was really fun. The 6th and 7th graders were entranced by what he did. He had some real cool, like, hands-on science stuff, and the kids were just thrilled with it. And then I wanted to thank Los Osos Middle School 6th grade teachers for letting me sit in on their collaborative meeting. They do a little meeting about noon, and I got a chance to see 4 of the teachers collaborate, and it was really great. And the opportunities that they have by having that common collaboration period, I think it's priceless. And the stuff they were doing and the work they were doing was really, really, really fun. And they all really appreciated that, too. So kudos to them and what they're doing out there. And then on a sad note, I did go to Beth Peterson's funeral. Beth was a longtime teacher in the district. Her husband, Larry, is a county board member. It was probably the most well-attended funeral I've ever been to. They filled up the Lutheran church in San Luis Obispo. There were 300 or 400 people there. She was beloved by everybody, and I know she will be missed. And then the last thing, I need to just let everybody know that I will not be at the next board meeting. I'm going to be back in D.C. For our legislative action program. It should be very interesting times because it looks like there's going to be a reauthorization of NCLB.
Yep.
And it's with some changes, with some significant changes, probably revolving around testing for sure. And so I look forward to hearing more about that and actually lobbying on behalf of all the school boards about local control and other things, which I'm not even sure about yet. So it should be pretty darn interesting.
Mr. Buckman.
Yes, thank you. I did have the opportunity. I can't go to all the boardwalks in the mornings because I have appointments, but I've been able to go sometimes in the afternoon. And I did get over to Monarch Grove, and Ms. Storm took me around. It was great. There's a sense of excitement and a lot of collaborative work among the students that was just great to see. I also attended the Tri-County Education Coalition on behalf of the board. The speaker this time was Nikki Sandoval, or Dr. Sandoval, who is on the State Board of Education, and it was well worth it. So if I can put together a report, I will do that. And then came up to the high school unannounced, and was not going to visit Mr. O'Connor, but he was running, somewhere to class, stopped and was going to talk to me. I said, no, you got to just keep going because you're going to set like a 60-yard dash record if you keep going. But it was good to get up there as well.
Okay. I just wanted to make another pitch. I know John O. Roberts mentioned the color run, but I just wanted to follow up with what that fund raises money for. And it's Alex Meyer, who tragically died in a car accident, I think that was 3 years ago now, number 23. His motto was choose happy. And so the idea of this, these are scholarships that are given, I believe $8,000 in scholarships were given out last year to students who answered an essay question, how do they live their life to choose happy? And so it's a different kind of approach to a scholarship, and it's a very meaningful community event, and I just wanted to give you all the details about it. 9 a.m. registration, 10 a.m. is the race, which is a walk race, as he said, and the pink stuff comes out of your hair really easily, so no worries about that.
Mr. Millar.
One of the things I noticed about it is there's a lot of inhalation of the colored stuff. Has there been any kind of research about the consequences of that?
It's cornstarch.
Perfect. Okay. That's got to be okay,
then. Anyone else? All right. Thank you very much. This meeting is adjourned. Our next meeting will be at Los Osos Middle School. Oh. Oh, board study session Friday, 1 to 4, B3. And then the next regularly scheduled board meeting is February 3rd, and it will be at Los Osos Middle School. Thank you very much.